Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, May 23rd, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern until midnight. If you're listening live over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140. Participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, send it to questions, plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be, Proverbs chapter 24, verses 1 through, I think, 14. Okay, Proverbs 24, 1 through 14. Be not thou envious against evil men, neither desire to be with them, for their heart studieth destruction, and their lips talk of mischief. Though wisdom is a house built, and by understanding is established, through wisdom is a house built, and by understanding it is established, and by knowledge shall the chambers be filled with all precious and pleasant riches. A wise man is strong, yea, a man of knowledge increaseth strength. For by wise counsels thou shalt make thy war, and in multitude of counselors there is safety. Wisdom is too high for a fool, he openeth not his mouth in the gate. He that deviseth to do evil shall be called a mischievous person. The thought of foolishness is sin, and the scorner is an abomination to men. If thou faint in the day of adversary, thy strength is small. If thou forbear to deliver them that are drawn unto death, and those that are ready to be slain, if thou sayest, behold, we knew it not, doeth not he that pondereth the heart considereth it? And he that keepeth thy soul, doeth not he know it? And shall not he render to every man according to his work? My son, eat thou honey, because it is good, and the honeycomb which is sweet to thy taste. So shall the knowledge of wisdom be unto thy soul. When thou hast found it, then there shall be an reward, and thy expectation shall not be cut off. Okay, that was Proverbs chapter 24, verses 1 through 14. Let me first, before we get started, call out to see if Brent is on the call. Brent, are you on the call tonight? I know you couldn't be here last week. I don't know if you'll be able to make it this week, but if you're here, let us know.
Yes.
Okay. All right, and you'll be ready to talk about a subject matter? I think we're going to go back and continue with militia, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right, we'll get to you in a short while then, a few minutes, okay?
Yes, I'll be here.
Okay. All right, anyway, I think we do have some questions. I saw something in the email. Gary, do we have any questions that came through email? Is Gary here? Gary, if you're talking, you're muted, I guess. We're not hearing you. Gary?
You were
okay,
here earlier.
Okay, let's see with SpongeBob?
Yeah.
All right, well, anyway, maybe we'll try some questions. Maybe he walked away from his computer. We'll try to see if he's got anything maybe after Brent finishes speaking. I don't have anything particular tonight, so I'm going to kind of move over into Brent. I did have a plan to share some things, but it hasn't been completely prepared yet, and I really did struggle for many days and over the weekend to try to get this prepared for tonight, but it's not going to happen. So we'll pick up on that next Monday, Lord willing. So tonight we'll go right into Brent. Brent's going to be speaking on the militia again. Brent is the author of the book Excellence in the Common Law by Brent Winters. That's his name. And his website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you've got the mic.
Thanks. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
I've been spending the week before this one traveling the state of Alaska, and I just found out we covered over 2,000 miles talking about the duties of the states and the duties of sheriffs, not to mention other office holders, to interpose themselves between the madness of the federal government and the states themselves, the people of the states. We're not talking about states removing themselves from the Union. That was settled on fields of battle. I don't believe it should be revisited. But I do believe that every office holder in America, state and federal, but I'm concentrating on the states, and the sheriff is included in that. His paycheck, the sheriff's paycheck, comes from the states, have a duty to interpose themselves between a federal government that says that your sons and your daughters must share the same bathroom and shower room. They have a duty to impose themselves between the federal government's draconian order to enforce such childish and dangerous stupidity. The way I got it so far, 12 states have said no, and I foresee a whole new subset of a body of constitutional law called bathroom law. The state of Texas put it in those terms. We believe that our law, they said, concerning bathrooms is constitutional. I do remember when there were two kinds of bathrooms in America. There were bathrooms for colored people, that's what the sign would often say, and bathrooms for white people, white and colored. Now, that's been done away with. That was, it is said now, since the 1950s. That's unconstitutional. Separate, said our U.S. Supreme Court, is inherently unequal. Well, that doesn't apply in this case. It is exceedingly fascinating how the evil empire, by creative design, attempts to circumvent true law. But that's what we're talking about. And the militia is part of that. Every person is, as the ancient people used to say, a magistrate. I don't like that word so much. It sounds ostentatious. But a magistrate is an office holder, someone who has a duty under the law. You could say that. And every office holder in America is required, according to the terms of our Constitution, to take an oath respecting the fundamental principles of our common law. Our Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. Chief Justice Taft of the U.S. Supreme Court put it in these words, I'm quoting, "The language of the Constitution cannot be interpreted safely except by reference to the common law." The Constitution, its language, said Chief Justice Taft, cannot be interpreted safely except by reference to the common law. Why? Because our Constitution is a common law, a document, a brief of common law government. Everything in it is the common law. Therefore, it says, Article 6, it is the supreme law of the land. That means due process. That's what our common law is. It is due process, fundamentally and at its heart. Well, the sheriffs figure into this, and the militia figures into this thing about standing between the madness of lawlessness and order. And liberty is only possible under the law of the true lawgiver. God himself, the Creator, says James the Apostle, the Creator of heaven and earth. To be sure, I'm quoting Granville Sharp, by the way, a student of the Greek New Testament and a foremost one. Granville Sharp said this, "The common laws always required the people to be armed, and not only armed, but to be expert in arms." He is an Englishman. He's gone now, died well over 250 years ago. He said, to be sure, the common laws always required the people, that is, the people of the English country, the English people, required them to be armed, and not only armed, but to be expert in arms. Our law, of course, is the law of England. It is the common law. And as we'd said before, no other country since Israel of old has ever enjoyed a law as clear and well-structured, respecting the personal right to keep and bear arms as our Constitution's four militia clauses. And by the Constitution's four militia clauses, the fundamental common law called the FIRD, we call it today the militia, was put to writing and set forth in terms of American government. Our Constitution, further, arranges duties under its militia clauses among four separate classes of men. Number one, congressmen. Number two, the separate office holders of the separate states of the Union. And number three, presidents of the United States. And number four, individual members of the militia. And we say again, because it bears repeating, every able-bodied man between the ages of 20 and 45 is, not can be or shall, but is a member of the militia of the several states. I'm quoting our Constitution when I use the phrase militia of the several states. First, our Constitution charges the Congress with providing rules for the separate states for calling forth the militia of the several states when called into service of the United States. To execute the laws of the Union, I'm quoting, to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections, that's number two, and repel invasions, that's number three. There are only three reasons that the President of the United States may call forth the militia of the several states or any part of them. Only three reasons he may do that. Number one, to execute the laws of the Union. Number two, to suppress insurrections. Number three, to repel invasions. And Congress, our Constitution says, may put in place, or must, really not may, no, indeed, it is a duty to put in place rules for governing the militia when called into the service of the United States. That's Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16. Second, our Constitution reserves to the states, that's each of them separately and respectively, the power to appoint officers of the militia of that state. And second, our Constitution gives to each state the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. You see, Congress has the power to put forth the rules that govern the militia of the several states or any part of them that are called into the service of the United States, and that only by the President, for one of the three reasons I just before mentioned. Congress provides those rules, and each state has the authority to put them in place and make them real. You see, there's a division of power here. We are a country of a common law. That's what we are. And the foundation of our common law is dispersion of power. That's why we are unlike any other country in the world, in that we have respective states that are sovereign. We're the only country in the world like that, to further disperse power. Accordingly, each state has the common law responsibility It's not an option. It's a responsibility to provide practical standards for its militia. What kind of firearm and the amount of ammunition each member must himself provide and safely keep. And number two, the level of training, discipline, and skill each member of the militia of each of the states must himself attain. Skill in safety, skill in marksmanship. That is the duty of the state legislature to talk about what, or to require what must be done in each individual person's case, each individual member of the militia of that state. Third, our Constitution gives the President of the United States, or any president that is then serving, the president's, plural, authority over any member of a state's militia only when called into actual service of the United States. The President of the United States has no authority over militiamen of each of the several states or any militiamen unless and until he calls them into the service of the United States. Before that, they are under the authority of the governor of that state and only if he musters them. The militia, you see, are not... They are what we call non-military people. They live outside of the jurisdiction of the martial law until they're mustered into service. So, Congress has certain duties respecting the militia of the several states. Each of the states have a respective duty, namely the appointment of the officers of the militia of that state. The federal government doesn't have the power, or the authority, I should say, doesn't have the right. It is not lawful for the president or Congress to appoint militia officers of the separate states. And then third, I had mentioned the Constitution gives presidents authority over any member of the militia only when called into the service of the United States. That's Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 through 16. And finally, and fourthly, our Constitution bars infringement upon the God-given individual right of each of the people and the people. By the way, that phrase, the people, as used in our Constitution, is an ancient way of saying the militia, the people. It's lifted from the Old Testament, the Hebrew phrase ha'am, which means the people. And in the Old Testament of our Bible, our first forefathers, the Puritans and the Pilgrims, took it that way, and that's the way they understood it, and that phrase has survived into our Constitution. And the two duties, of course, the militia, are armed defense and jury duty, grand and petit. That's enemies foreign, that's armed defense, enemies domestic, that's jury duty, or the willingness, and the willingness, I should say, of going into court and defending rights and the rights of our common law. So the Constitution bars infringement upon the members of the militia to keep and bear arms. That means loaded guns. It's fascinating to me as I watch the regulations put upon people possessing firearms that increasingly they are forbidden from having loaded guns. In some states, if you get caught by a game warden with more than X number of shells in your shotgun, you'll be arrested. I know people of which have had that problem. But it's a matter of having, it's an infringement to disallow X number of rounds in a firearm. So forbidding infringement means that there's not to be any act that interferes with this individual right to keep and carry a loaded gun. By the way, there is no other kind of right but individual. There are no corporate rights. There are no association rights. Those are false words, often used, though. Watch for them. Rights are individual rights. Always, God gives rights to individuals, direct, without the mediator. And that's what the right to keep and bear arms is, because it is that common, as Blackstone puts it, that common natural right of one's ability to defend one's self. And in our world today, one cannot really effectively defend oneself with a shillelagh if someone else has a gun and someone else, namely, in this case, the government, is well-armed. And the Second Amendment is all about that. And it arose, of course, out of our experience as Americans in that war for separation from the British Empire. Simply put, Amendment 2 bars the national government. Amendment 2, you see, is the fourth of four militia clauses. But Amendment 2 bars the national government or any state government now from interfering, that means infringement, hampering, impeding, any one of the people's non-delegable right and duty to keep and bear arms. Indeed, if our Second Amendment stands for anything, it stands for this, namely, security and freedom at the same time. Security and freedom at the same time, because both are possible only as each militiaman of each state fulfills his duty in accord with our Constitution's four militia clauses. What is his duty? It is to keep and bear arms and ammunition and to carry them on his person when he believes it's necessary. That's the duty. No, not the option. Rights are not options. Rights are never options. We've hackneyed that word until it has lost its meaning. It now means, in most people's minds, something selfish. It is not something selfish. It is a duty, and that is the meaning of the old Germanic word Reich. It means duty. The Germans, the Germans, and the Germanic people have another word for law that bespeaks rights as we would understand them, something selfish, something that I must defend in that way. And you do defend a duty. I'm trying to put into words concepts. I'm not doing a very good job. Just to say this, a right is not something that is to be used for one's selfishness. A right is one's duty towards oneself and toward others before God, and you'll answer for it if you don't fulfill your duty. Each person has a duty of protection of himself as much as he can, and protection of his wife and his children, his spouse or her spouse and children also. These are fundamental rights. The right of self-protection, again, a fundamental right, is a right that God drops direct on the individual with no intermediator, and it is non-delegable, and with that right comes the duty to defend it, by the way. In the event Congress neglects our Constitution's mandate to provide rules for training the militia of the several states, as indeed it has, our Constitution requires each state to organize, arm, discipline, and train its own militia. Congress has obviously ignored its duty under our Constitution's militia clauses. Presidents of the United States, also for the last 175 years approximately, have ignored their duty. It's not an option, it's a duty under the militia clauses of our Constitution of the United States. State legislators and governors have ignored their duty. So make sure you don't ignore yours. You have a duty to remain armed as a member, able-bodied member of the militia of the several states. Cite a couple of cases here that support what I'm saying, and a lot of what I'm saying comes out of, in brief statements, out of Justice Joseph Story's commentaries on the Constitution, written about 39 years after the Constitution's, our Constitution's, ratification. But also compare the militia clauses that we'd mentioned, and then Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3, and the Second Amendment. Compare that with Houston versus Moore. 18 U.S. 1, 5 Wheaton, the year 18 and 20. And then also U.S. versus Marigold. Marigold, M-A-R-I-G-O-L-D, that's 50 U.S., 9 Howard, these are old kind of sites, but 9 Howard, 50 U.S., 9 Howard, page 560, most specifically 567, that's from the year 18 and 50. And in the event both Congress and the several states neglect our Constitution's mandates to them by way of the militia clauses, as indeed they have, the people, that is, the militia men themselves, must never neglect their constitutional required right to keep themselves forearmed and skilled, as Granville Sharp said, skilled in the use of arms. To be sure, if the people, that is, the militia, fail to fulfill this fundamental duty, the national government will gain an absolute monopoly of violent force and power, and will evermore both dominate the states and oppress the people, as we now see is happening, ever increasingly happening. A monopoly of force and violence because they have ignored the militia clauses. In all events, our Constitution assigns none of these tasks in these militia clauses to any army, to any navy, to any National Guard, which is constitutionally unknown, the National Guard, and it does not assign any of these duties, least of all, to any police force or any bureaucratic agency. I used to be in the mining industry out west, and we mined on what is called BLM land. The Federal Mining Law of 1872 is the companion act to the Homestead Act of the 1860s. The Homestead Act was passed to populate the agricultural land, the tillable land of the United States. That was done pretty much by the last part of the 19th century and then on into the first two decades of the 20th century, it was completed. But the population of the mineralized lands of the United States has never been completed. Therefore, the mining law of 1872 is still in force in theory. It used to be in force in fact 30 years ago when I operated on Bureau of Land Management land, federal land, with mining claims. In those days, hadn't been that long ago, BLM officers didn't carry firearms because laws of Congress forbade them utterly from carrying firearms. Now, today, BLM employees are not only armed, but they are armed and dressed to appear as though they are jack-booted thugs, and have shown themselves to be so in a number of instances. That's a monopoly of force and violence that is increasing. I'm amazed even going into courtrooms, and I'm speaking now of state courts, but it's a culture of that kind of attitude, that bailiffs don't wear ties and nice clothing. They wear fatigues, and they tuck their fatigues into their boots. When I was a military man, there were only certain units allowed to do that, and only on certain occasions, because it's not part of what a person would consider, and used to consider, to be a well-dressed member of the armed forces. Men in the field did it, of course, but these fellows are doing it in the courtroom. Women now also, of course. So it is increasingly a monopoly on force and violence. The readiness of the militia of the several states is the supreme law of the land. Allow me to repeat that one. The readiness of the militia of the several states is the supreme law of the land. The supreme law of the land, Article 6. That's a quote from yours truly. It is the readiness that is the supreme law of the land. The militia is not the supreme law of the land. Indeed, keep in mind, the supreme law of the land means, as our Supreme Court of the United States has recognized on a number of instances, they got this one right. They've said in the past that phrase, supreme law of the land means due process. Lifted direct from Magna Carta, law of the land, terra. Law of the land, terra, land, is translated from the Magna Carta, from Magna Carta's words, terra, lex terra, law of the land. And it is the process, how, H-O-W, our militia is supposed to operate, that is in view as the supreme law of the land. That's why we say it is the readiness of the militia. Readiness, yes, it says regular. Regular. The militia is to be regular. That's the words of our Constitution. You know, the word regular appears elsewhere in our Constitution. Commerce is to be also regular. Military men talk about the regular army and the regular navy to distinguish them from the weekend warriors. They've done that for a long, long time, and it's an important distinction to use the word regular. Regular means ready. Ready. You see, the regular navy and army are the most ready. The Navy is always on patrol, always armed, has been this way. They're different even from the Army in that respect. The Army has to tool up when we go to war. The Navy is already on watch. They're armed and ready. But the more ready you are, the more regular you are. It's, I suppose, a matter of gradation. But a regular militia is a militia that is a minute man kind of militia. It's always ready, regular. Regular means always ready. Don't ever forget that. And that is the reason why the Second Amendment says that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That means to keep and carry a loaded gun. That means you're ready. You're regular. The same thing is true of commerce, of course. When it says that commerce is to be regular, that means it is to never, ever stop flowing. It is to be always moving, always regular, never dammed up, so to speak. Well, if it does not remain so, that is, does not remain ready, if the militia is not regular, the criminal law industry's police state thugs will further swell into the void, as is now seen. Americans continue to ignore the common law first principles of our Constitution's militia clauses, at great peril to their freedom. At great peril to their freedom. I'm not quoting Justice Joseph's story of the U.S. Supreme Court, but I am summarizing one of his paragraphs. And his greatest fear when he wrote his commentaries on the Constitution, 39, 38, 39, almost 40 years after our Constitution, the people ratified it, his greatest fear, he said, was that the militia clauses would be slowly eroded and ignored. Not so much that people would fight against them, but that they would ignore them. And our presidents, congressmen, state governors, and legislators, those three classes of persons have utterly now ignored their duties, their bounden duties, their required non-delegable duties, under the militia clauses of our Constitution. The state militias, being the people themselves, are no creation of our Constitution. Rather, our Constitution simply recognizes their existence. They are. You can't get rid of them. Armed or not, the militia is always there. The able-bodied men able to bear arms in battle. In fact, because the militia is, as also is the jury, it is a part of the people. Our Supreme Court says these are a subset of the people. Because some of the people are not all able at every moment to bear arms. That's true, for whatever reason, infirmity, sickness, disability. And, of course, age eventually gets to a man. I understand now why young men fight wars. I didn't understand so much until I was no longer the youngest of men. Neither government nor even the people can end the militia or alter its fundamental right. When I say militia, I should say the separate militias of the several states. In fact, both the militias of the several states, that's not good Latin, but the militia of the several states, each one of them and the jury, are subsets of the people, those very persons establishing and ordaining our Constitution of the United States. And I'm going to end there And Lord willing, if I'm able to come back again, and I appreciate being able to come and say these things, Lord willing, next time I'll begin expounding and breaking down the first militia clause, which says this: Congress shall have the power to provide for calling forth a militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for the governing of such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16. We'll talk about those next time. Thanks, John. And if you want me to stay and give people an opportunity to ask questions, I'll do that. If not, I'll just quit.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Yeah, we'll take a few calls. Let me open up to Q&A. We'll take a few callers for Brent. So let me go into the Q&A. Anybody that has a question or a comment for Brent, hit star 6, get into the queue, and Brent will take calls for about 20 minutes or so. Okay, we have Eric from Georgia, it looks like. Go right ahead. You've got the mic.
Thanks. When Brent was talking about the people, just so that it's not confused, because, I mean, I think I understand it, but talking about the people being the militia and that the translation of the people from old common law is the militia, well, is this not in turn saying that in our Constitution, according to the Second Amendment, that only the militia can carry? Because I know you've talked about that before already, can carry arms, but that everyone's the militia and everyone, of course, you were saying that beforehand, that everyone should be armed. But just to avoid any confusion, well, at least on my part, you're not saying that only the militia can bear arms.
No, right? And I appreciate you making that distinction. I tend to talk in terms of the rawness of our common law. I love to go back to the fountain. I love to go back to the fountain and talk about the way things are. But our common law is the law of the city people and the rest of the world say it's messy. It's messy, and it is. It's messy. Its language is sometimes messy, and certainly jury trials can get real messy. Well, they don't have that kind of thing in there. They're all about precision, like the Germans during World War II. Very precise, good engineers. They really know how to be precise. And of course, the metric system of France, it is contrary to the English system of measurement. It's so incredibly precise, but that doesn't always get us to liberty. That's an important point to make. But no, I'm not saying that. What it's saying is this: the Second Amendment, human speech, and our stammering and stuttering is not always perfect. But what it's saying, of course, is that the right of the people to keep and bear arms, it says, shall not be infringed. And it was well understood at that time, in the United States especially, and as Benjamin Franklin said to the people in France and to the people in England, you are not appreciative. You are not appreciative of our rustic and rough circumstances in the New World. We are a gun culture. People don't have the right to carry guns and don't know how to use them. They die often. And in those days, we were facing a whole lot of unusual things, not to mention the British government going so far as to trying to kill off the entire population of the colonies with smallpox during the course of our War of Separation, the vicious brutality. So that was, the guns were nothing compared to what they were trying to do, and every person in America is understood to have that right. We've never regulated it until very recently. And, of course, it is dangerous, a very dangerous thing. Guns are dangerous pieces of equipment. But to disallow people from carrying them is, the alternative is unthinkable. It's so much more hellish you can't imagine. Well, we can't imagine by reading history, but we as Americans have not had that experience yet. We read about what happened in Europe before and during the war, and we read about what happened to the Armenian people, 1.5 million of them slaughtered immediately after they were disarmed, a peace-loving, quiet, intelligent Christian nation, the first Christian nation on the face of our planet. They were slaughtered that way. So, no, I'm not saying that. I'm glad you brought it up. But I am speaking of the common law as it was, and our history. Where does this come from? Why do we understand it this way? And our forefathers did indeed lift that phrase from the Old Testament. The Pilgrims, which they were a sect of the Puritans, and the Puritans also, and as Winston Churchill said, I think he's right. From my understanding of history, our forefathers were the most beautiful race of men that ever lived, and their understanding of the militia, they wedded from the Old Testament, the Older Testament of the Bible, and it's very precise. They wedded that, the laws of nature's God, that's what it's called, or as with nature on that
nature.
I think we lost Brent there for a second. Brent, are you there?
Brent, are you there?
Brent?
We also picked up an echo, John.
Oh, hold on. Brent is muted. Let me unmute him over there. Okay. You there, Brent?
I'm here.
Okay,
I'm here.
We lost you for about 30 seconds or so.
I'm echoing. I can hear myself.
Do you have two lines open?
Not to my knowledge. I could try to call back.
Okay, we've got someone else. Let me delete Robert there. I think we're coming through Robert. Try it now.
All right. Are we okay?
I think so. Go right ahead.
Okay.
All right, you wanted to finish off, and we'll take our next caller. You were finishing off with Eric from Georgia, but go right ahead.
Oh, unless there was something else I needed to say, that I'm glad he brought it up. Thank you, Eric, for clarify that point.
Thank you, Brent. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Eric. Okay, let's go to Jeremiah from California. You got the mic. Go right ahead. What's your question or comment for Brent?
Hello, Brent. This is Donaldson Jeremiah here in California. How you doing?
I'm all right. Hope you are. Are you calling from the big city or up north, or where are you?
I'm in Chinatown, San Francisco, right now.
Well, I'm that part of the world. I've been there, and I could tell you a lot of things about Chinatown, but maybe you live there. What's your question? I don't mean to delay you.
We could talk about the communist all day, but we won't. The question is militia, right? Clause of the United States Constitution.
Uh-huh.
You said it applies to the all the states.
Right? Uh-huh.
Well, is that including states that were admitted into the Union post-Civil War? And not only that, but even prior or after the 13 colonies, which there are cases that support, like, in, for example, a California case in 2010. I don't forget the name of it right now, but it's a California truck owner who claimed to be the people of this state and had the right to travel, right?
Uh-huh.
But the court came back and found that because California was not one of the original states in the, you know, as defined in the Articles of Confederation,
uh-huh,
right, that uh-huh, the right to travel did not apply. It did not, because it wasn't the same setup. It wasn't the same agreement.
Uh-huh.
So my question to you is about the militia clauses of the U.S. Constitution and how uh-huh they apply to states admitted uh-huh into the Union, even on the premise of equal footing.
Well, the Supreme Court of the United States has recently ruled, and in their ruling they assume, and rightly assume, that the militia clauses apply to the entire United States. All the jurisdictions that the Constitution gives the United States authority to operate within the Constitution, to, in other words, reach and out and touch people in those individual states, the general government of Washington, D.C., Our Supreme Court has recognized, and rightly so. I'm not familiar with the case of which you speak. I know there's a lot of weird stuff out there when it comes to what judges say, and I try to remember that judges, appellate judges, are just men, and they are fallible men, and they are sometimes so wrong. For example, the Supreme Court of the United States has reversed itself on a number of occasions, as has the Supreme Courts and the appellate courts of the states. That's why we have three branches of government, because the courts are not the final word on anything, never have been, regardless of what people say. I took a Constitution test when I got out of high school, had to take it to graduate. I'm glad I did. I learned more. Oh, I learned an awful lot that all my dealings with the law after that failed to talk about. One of them was this, that the branches of government are co-equal. Co-equal. That means this, that every person that holds office in government, as I'd said a while ago, takes an oath, not to the Supreme Court, but an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And it is an individual duty of each person to decide for himself, and each office holder, of course, what is constitutional and what is not. Marbury versus Madison. Marbury versus Madison even taught, this befoggles me to no end. It's taught that Justice Marshall in that case ruled that the Supreme Court had trumping power over the other two branches of government. That's not in that case at all. Justice Marshall simply said this, and rightly said this. He said the Supreme Court of the United States has a duty to review all legislation if it's brought up before them for constitutionality. It has a duty to do that. Well, is that any different than the duty of the President of the United States to review legislation that comes before him for his signature for constitutionality? Does that have any? Is there any difference between the Supreme Court and a congressman or a senator's duty to review everything that he is asked to do or any vote he's asked to make for constitutionality? Is that any different than the Supreme Court of an individual state, such as New York, Indiana, Illinois, Montana, the Supreme Court, and each one of the justices of the Supreme Court of the several states, from reviewing everything they look at for constitutionality? No. Texas said, the people in Texas, the government officials in Texas said, we believe our laws concerning bathrooms are constitutional. I love it. Well, they're right. They have a duty to review the constitutionality. The Supreme Court of the United States did not gain, never had the idea, and no one in America had the idea, that it was trumping everything, was to trump the other two branches of government, or the Supreme Court of the state of California, until a man by the name of Austin Baird wrote a book about it and claimed it was true. He was a communist. He wrote the book about 1910, a Quaker by religion, communist by political inclination, so much so he'd been dismissed from several teaching positions. The Quakers have made a lot of mistakes because of their misunderstanding, their faulty understanding of the fundamental nature of man. They are the father, the Quakers are the father of the penitentiary system in America. Penitentiary system, what a ridiculous, ridiculous boondoggle that has become. Well, I'm just making the point that men are men, and because men are fallible, our national motto is in God we trust, not in government we trust, not in money we trust, not in religion we trust. We trust in God. That means the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. We trust His will, the two volumes of the revelation of His will to mankind. And the Supreme Court of California, this case of which you speak, I'm not familiar, but
It's unconstitutional, you're saying?
Well, of course, the Supreme Court has recently ruled in the year 2008 that that couldn't be the case. Let me hasten ahead and then I'll let you talk. That doesn't mean that what the Supreme Court said is the law. That means that the Constitution, of course, expresses the law and we're to support it. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You said that the Constitution is the law and what?
And that we are bound, and our office holders especially, are bound to support the Constitution of the United States.
Right, there you have it. So the case is Cal App 5 Dist So it's California Appellate Court, 5th District, 2012. It says California truck owner was not among the people of each state whose right to free ingress and regress to and from any other state was acknowledged by the Articles of Confederation, since California was not one of the states in this union or a state as the term was used in the Articles of Confederation.
How old is that case?
That is from 2012.
That's, what's the name of the case again?
It is Halajian, Halajian. So I think it's Halajian. D, capital D, and then ampersand, the and symbol. So D&B, D&B Towing. So Halajian v. D&B Towing. The citation is 146 Cal Reporter 3rd, 646. And it was even, of course, it was even appealed, of course, in the and then in the 5th District in 2012. It was appealed in the 4th, but then in the 5th, apparently.
Well, I shouldn't comment on the case, because often when this kind of thing happens, somebody will bring something up to me, and I read it myself, and I find out there's a whole lot more to it than what we're talking about. So I there may be, there may not be. And it doesn't bear directly on the right to keep and bear arms, but I see that you're trying to see if the principle would apply over there. And I'll look at it. I don't know.
Isn't that interesting, though? I mean, to it's a little bit of a devil's advocate position, but it's a healthy one, because of the fact that when we investigate whether or not we have that original agreement in place here, right, in California or in the several states that are not considered to be referenced in the Articles of Confederation. And so this may, perhaps there's a bit of judicial deference being handed out by oath takers, right, who are just basically giving away, saying, okay, that's okay, we trust you that you're making the constitutional choice in your state. We trust that you're making the constitutional choice in your local community, and deference is when a judge says, hey, I trust the decision of that lower department.
Well, then the presumption, since the 1930s, there's key cases there. Caroline Products, I think, is probably the most key case. The presumption is that the government's right, and the burden is then on the person challenging the constitutionality of the regulation or the law. And before Roosevelt, that was just the opposite. In other words, as power increased, the presumption against the lawfulness of the act increased, not decreased. And we've got it the other way around now, and that is putting the Constitution on its head. That's why Lord Dalberg Emmerich Acton, said that there is no doctrine more dangerous to mankind than the doctrine that says that the office sanctifies the man. And then he said this, all in the same quote here, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. He was referencing, just in passing, to give you the whole story, he was referencing the recent proclamation of the Pope of Rome that when he's got his haunches sitting on the throne, the Lateran Council, it's impossible for him to speak air. And Acton was a Roman Catholic. He said, that's ludicrous. Of course it's ludicrous. We've got people sitting on the bench of the Supreme Court of the United States that say it's okay for men and women, or men to bump body parts and get married and have certificates and get all the benefits of the law of marriage. That's ludicrous. Obviously, they're wrong. Obviously. And anyone who would say otherwise, God help them. We don't go along with that. For the President of the United States or the governors to support that is a violation of their oath. I'm not going to say it's treason like a lot of people do. That's another matter, treason. Our Constitution defines treason for us. And in each state defines treason as to that state. But that is a violation utterly of their oath. Of course, if you're going to have somebody sitting on the court that does those kind of things, and apparently these people admit they do it, the people, those persons sitting on the court, we shouldn't expect anything else. But I like to say publicly and say often, I'm not part of this crowd. I don't do that. And I do not support what they're doing. It's wrong, dead wrong. And
let
we
me
often
ask you,
yes.
How important?
We got some other people. Hold on, Jeremiah. We got some other people. You know,
I know, but this is kind of important.
Make it short.
My last question.
Brent,
okay.
Brent can answer it shortly. We'll move to another.
Thank you, Brent. Thank you, John. How important is, getting judicial approval to like running these ideas by the judges? You know, the committee reports and things of that nature by the local judges. Is that something that is viable? And then if those judges determine that it's unlawful or they don't move on these committees' reports, right? Is that one, you know, like an area where we could then discipline the judge or know for sure, okay, now we're going to have to actually, you know, kind of work around the
let me just say shortly this. Everything must be done according to due process, according to the common law, according to the process that the Constitution lays down or the Constitution of each of the states. And to deal with judges that have gone rogue, we have process in place, lawful process, and we are to proceed that way. And I want to make deference to John. He wants to move on, so we're going to have to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Jeremiah. I appreciate your questions. Okay. Our next caller is David. Go right, David. David, what state are you from?
Hello. Can you hear me?
How you doing, David? We can hear you. What state are you from?
State of Missouri.
State of Missouri. Go
I'm
ahead.
Getting
what's
an
your
echo here, too.
Comment for Brent? What's your comment for Brent?
I'm sorry?
What's your question?
Well, my comment to Brent, I truly believe that he is one of the wisest men I've ever listened to. And I would ask him again to tell me what the name of that book is about the militia.
Oh,
so I can get one.
Well, those are kind words, and I appreciate them. But I know a lot of people, a whole lot smarter than wiser than me, and I read them and I listen to them. And I'm looking for somebody, always looking for somebody wiser, and I hope you're doing the same thing. But that's kind of you to say. That's encouraging. The name of the book is. The militia of the several states, the militia of the several states, are Constitution's answer to its enemies, foreign and domestic. Our Constitution's answer to its enemies, foreign and domestic. And you can get that, I believe, at Amazon.com. If you just type in my name, Brent Allen Winters, that's A-L-L-A-N, not E-N, A-N, all the books that I've written, except one, I think, will come up. The only one that doesn't come up is the Winters Annotated Bible. Common Lawyer translates and makes comment. But the militia book is on Amazon.com. You can also, Amazon.com. I think you can find it at CommonLawyer.com, too.
All right. I appreciate that. And I've got a question for John, if you may.
Yeah, go ahead.
If I may, rather.
Question. Yeah, go right ahead, David. I'll try to answer quickly.
John, I'm working already on the Committee of Safety in the state of Missouri. But I'm finding myself without an answer to be handing out this information on the power of the authority of the sheriff. That was told that I should give that to people in the fire department. I have known sheriffs in this town, and St. Louis County or St. Louis proper is not have a sheriff that has the qualifications you're talking about.
Well, yeah, so, a lot of the sheriffs out there, they just don't have the knowledge. They're as ignorant as we are or were. At least we are trying to get rid of our ignorance through knowledge. And so, they have the same problem we had. And they need to learn. So we need to convince them to take a look at things, to consider, what the true history of the sheriff is and what his authority, by what authority he acts and what powers that he actually does happen and who he actually is. He's the chief administrator of executive administrator of the county and also but he's also the peacekeeper.
You're addressing the sheriff when it's a policeman who's in charge.
Right. Well, some people have that problem in those counties, and we're going to have to fix that as time goes on. We have eight
counties. Well, I understand that, but in the meantime,
yeah.
I've got a problem here in Missouri.
Yeah, you do. We have a problem here in New York in seven counties, and same problem. And we have a problem in Connecticut with eight counties, and a few other states that have the same problems. And it's something we will address very, very quickly once we can, you know, get to the other side of things and be able to address those issues. You know, we might take on those issues at some point early on, you know, to put more pressure on these people in the courts as we're moving through the cases that we're moving through right now. But right now the plan is really getting onto the other side and then make sure we establish sheriffs for these counties that don't have them. So it's a problem. We're doing the best that we can to try to educate
people. Well, I understand, John.
And realize it. So.
I'm not complaining. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of in a trick bag.
Right.
Trying to talk about sheriffs when we don't have any.
Well, in certain places you don't, and in a lot of places you do have sheriffs, and you still don't have sheriffs because they don't understand their power and authority.
Well,
we
I can help that problem a lot easier than where they don't have one at all.
Well, that's true. You know, we did have one sheriff recently, very recently, who said that they understood that the judge and the lawyers were breaking the law, but he decided he actually said this, and he was going to, you know, obey the judge anyway. And that's exactly how he put it. And that's pretty bad, and, you know, we're going to be talking with him a little bit more. But again, this is what you get. You get ignorant people. You get criminals even in the sheriff's office from time to time. But generally speaking, we're in a hope that most sheriffs that we have met anyway seem to be reasonable, but they're confused. They just don't know their knowledge. They don't understand the knowledge of their authority and the knowledge that they need to acquire for their history. And again, we're going to do our best to give it to them. And if you go out to, you know, our website and click on the the COS, or just put in nationallibertyalliance.org/COS, or go to the page with the county sheriff, you can find them both on the tabs. You will find a 35-page paper which you can give to the sheriff, and hopefully he'll read it, and hopefully he'll start to consider who he really is and what his job really is, what his duty is, you know. So,
well,
anyway, I'm going to move forward. You can come back on if you want and ask more questions. I don't want to take Brent's time.
Okay, Brent, thank you very much. I think you're a very brilliant man, and I'll listen to you when you're on.
Thank
God
you, and
you're
important to me because I don't always feel
thanks,
that way.
John.
Yeah.
Thank you, I appreciate it. Okay, all right, we're going to take a few more calls. We have Gigi been waiting for a while, so Gigi, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Gigi. Gigi, can you hear us? I think I hear something there. One more call for Gigi. You got the mic. Go right ahead. Let me just try another thing. How's that? Can you talk now, Gigi? Okay, I guess Gigi's away from the phone. Okay, let's take Eric from Georgia. You got the mic. Go right ahead, Eric. Eric? You got the mic, Eric.
Hello, John?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I didn't know it was that short. I already talked to Brent. I'll just get back in later.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to 434 phone number. You've got the mic. 434 is the area code.
Hello.
Yeah, how you doing? Give us your first name and your state, please.
I'm in the state of Virginia. My name is Carla.
Carla from Virginia. Go right ahead with your question for Brent.
Yes. Hi, Brent. How are you?
Hi. Okay.
Hi. Okay. Well, it seems like I'm the youngest one on here. I just recently joined National Liberty Alliance about a couple weeks ago. And before then, you know, I have some pages that I am the administrator on where I help families and give them advice. And I get calls daily for legal advice. And, you know, I'm still learning the laws myself because I was blind for 7 years. And so that I had, now that I have joined the committee on here for safety, what do I do? What is the first thing that I should do as going about gathering people in the state of Virginia? And I still, on top of that,
yeah,
I still have...
That might be a better question for me than you, Brent, no?
That's what I was getting ready to say, yeah.
Yeah, you know, one of the things we're doing is the best thing to do if you're going to work to build a committee of safety in your county is, you know, get the documentation, a lot of help up there on our webpage, and to go through that and learn a little bit about how to pull a committee together and things of those natures. And you're going to be surprised when you get a hold of some other people, especially if you visit some local liberty groups, you'll find that they've already got some experience in putting together a committee or been involved and how to work in these kind of things using what's called, you know, the Roberts Rules of Order. But anyway, you know, we have a lot of instructional sheets, and you get together with people. You can find a lot of people in liberty groups. When they hear about the Committee of Safety and they understand the potential of it within their own counties, I know they'll grip on, grip on to this, because this is what we were looking for. I was looking for when I was working in liberty groups locally. So that's what you want to do. And also, you might want to look for people that belong to National Liberty Alliance that are maybe in your state or in your county. We do, you know, you get a hold of the national leadership. You can go to the directory. They can help you find state leadership, and they can also help you find some county coordinators maybe, and even just members and people you can work with, and they can share phone numbers with you, and you can get together talking with them and meet with them and work within your county to do whatever it is you have to do.
Well, okay? I just a woman reached out to me by the name of Laura. Her last name is Ledger or something like that. I'm not really sure. But she said that she had an appointment where I live, and she wanted to come by and meet me. So she came by and met me. And, you know, I have a four-year-old, so she's kind of running around. So I think she kind of chased her off a little bit. But I told her to call me back, and she had told me that that she would, you know, try to help me get some things together. But she lives almost 2 hours from me. I live in the Blue Ridge Mountains. I live in Waynesboro, Virginia. And where I live, there's not a whole lot going on here. I've had a case that's been going on for 7 years in Charlottesville, Virginia. Charlottesville, Albemarle County in Virginia. And I have learned so many things along the way, and the corruption here in the state of Virginia is ridiculous. I just found out in April that several agencies, pediatricians, doctors, therapists, psychologists, special aid teachers, they're all involved in this medical fraud ring here in Virginia. And I'm trying to expose it little by little as far as my case. And so what do I do when you have a judge that's been a judge? He's been a judge for about 40 years. And you find out that this man is involved in a scandal where he is basically selling children to the highest bidder. What do I do here?
Yeah,
you know,
this is a problem. This is a problem, surprisingly, we're coming up to across the nation. It's a very serious problem, and it's a very difficult problem to deal with, especially because these people feel confident to be able to get away with this, and they got a whole high profile. They got a high profile themselves, and yet they don't seem to hide some of this stuff very well. And
no, they don't. They're very sloppy here.
Yes,
they're very sloppy. They do it right in front of you.
They feel, right, they seem to feel very confident and comfortable that ain't nobody going to do nothing to me. And that's the attitude they have. But Their day is coming. The day of justice, Lord willing, if we're successful, I do believe we will be successful, all we got to do is continue to do the right thing. At some point in time, justice will come. One way or the other, justice will come. There's no doubt about that. And God will deal with them. And very well maybe dealing with them through the courts of justice where God is the king. And we'll bring them into those courts of justice possibly, and I think we probably will. And the people will make a decision on what to do with this individual. But until then, yeah, it's real tough. I mean, we do what we can with what we know about, but it's a tough uphill battle. And for you to try to approach something like that would be very difficult, very frightening for you. You wouldn't be able to control it. You'd probably lose and get beat up pretty bad and maybe even end up in jail. So you've got to be real careful. But pray about it. And work with the people in your neighborhood, and let's work for justice. Once you get the numbers together, and if we can move into the courts, then we can bring these people to justice.
Well, I've already taken down one circuit court judge. I have my mother is a retired police officer from Henrico County in Virginia. She's retired, and I got a lot of my mother in me, but I just, you know, as far as, you know, fighting for what's right and everything, but when you find out, you know, for instance, in my case, and my case is still kind of going on, I had trial Monday the 16th, and when I had brought my evidence, and I had brought in front of the court, I had brought the tampering with evidence, medical fraud, covering up of child abuse, and so forth, and basically, I had asked the other attorney during recess, I said, why do you have my name in all capital letters? I am not a corporation. And this assistant state attorney went off on me and cursed me out like a dog and basically sits there and laughs about it and says that he could do what he damn well pleases, that it's recess, ha, ha, ha.
It's not worth bringing those things up to them because it's exactly what they do. They do laugh at us when we bring up the fiction. And a lot of them do understand it, but some of them don't. And that's why we go in with reality and we ignore the fiction and we talk about justice and righteousness and Supreme Court rulings and, of course, that are constitutional. And we bring in the common law and we do the best we can, and
that's what I'm trying
to
learn now.
It's all an uphill battle.
That's what I'm trying to learn now, and right now, like, I need to be filing a declaratory. I can't pronounce the word. Sorry, judgment. The judge, you know, because I brought all of my evidence in front of court.
We can't get into specific cases on a Monday night call, but you know, and again, you know, be very careful when you go into these courts because they will find you for contempt. Now, if you've got some experience and you think you can control it, and you know, that means that the judge has to fear you a little bit. It means that there's something about you he doesn't understand, and he's uncertain, and he feels threatened by you in some way, that he would allow you to get away with some of these things. Because you're only going to push him so far. If you don't give him a way to escape to begin with, and you put him in a corner, like putting a rat in a corner, he's going to bite you. And
yeah.
So I'd be very, very careful. And
I've been bitten off and on for three years.
Yeah. All right,
I've
well,
been bitten off and on for 3 years. But I just wanted to,
yeah,
you know.
It's tough, you know, get more knowledge and get ready for the other side. You know, look, work to get to the other side because that's our solution. The other side is really finally getting through the courts and getting justice back into the courts. And it's an uphill battle, and we're only going to reach that when we hit critical mass. And I want to tell you, we are extremely close to critical mass, and it's just a matter of time. So it's all in God's timing, and when it happens, we're going to come down, hammer down, and, you know, the walls of resistance will fall at some point. But appreciate the call, and you know, if you want to get back in line again and ask some more, you're welcome. Okay.
Thank you.
I want to take at least one more question for Brent before we let him go. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Jan. Go right ahead. This will be your last call, Brent.
Beautiful.
Thanks,
Mr. Brent. How was Alaska? I hear you were out there.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, nice people.
All righty. I sent the request to contact you through your contact thing on your site, and I hadn't heard from you until I found out that you're out of state, but internet covers the world pretty much. I need to get a hold of you. I got a interesting case where I was they were supposed to enter almost a $50,000 judgment on me today for they want me to pay their legal fees on a case they started on me that they created. That's international property maintenance code violations and international fire code violations, which are all unlawful. They're legal, but they're all unlawful.
So, who wants to pay them? Who's on the other side? Some state?
Township. The township.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
So I know we're talking personal, but this affects the whole country because this thing is creeping in to the cities and townships like some kind of parasite, like some kind of rats, like some kind of varmints. And this thing needs to be stopped, and COS is one of the ways of doing it, but COS isn't going to happen in my county in time or my township in time to help me. So I need to contact you. So if you can give me your personal phone to John, which he probably has, or give him permission so I can get it from him or Gerard or Jan.
Did you email your phone number to me?
I filled out your contact thing on your website.
Oh, well, I'll just have to follow up and see what I can do. No, I haven't seen that, but we'll look. And if you have trouble, if John's willing, you'd have to ask him. He could pass along the information. I could call you.
Okay.
Yeah, John, I know Jan. I know Jan. So, Brent, if you don't get any information on him in the next, you know, when you check your email tomorrow or something or your papers, you can give me a call, let me know, and then I'll get that information to Jan, and you guys can make a connection.
Yeah,
but,
I got extension to June 27th, and I need to find an attorney, and you are a lawyer. So John says to engage with you, so I want to or need to engage.
What state are you in again?
Michigan.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be talking probably then. I appreciate you.
We need to engage somehow or another. I need to get some ideas or suggestions, or if you can or you can't, because as John says, engage with Brent. So the ball's in your park.
No, I'm glad you called and let me know. Well, we'll get hooked up then.
All righty, sir.
All right,
okay, thank you,
John. Thank you, John. Bye now.
All right, thanks a lot, Brent. We appreciate your time here, and Lord willing, we'll be seeing you next week. Hang out for a while if you want, and we'll take the next caller. Thanks.
Okay, bye.
Gerard. All right. Gerard, are you ready to take control here?
There I am.
Okay, I'm relinquishing them. I'm not going to hit the next question. You need to hit the next question to dump Jan.
Okay. Hey, listen. Hey, Brent, are you still there? I just want to bring up a point on a couple of the questioners. You know, why do we split hairs the way we do about sheriffs and oaths of offices and who's the top cop? I was under the assumption that if you have an oath of office, that is the Constitution. You're supposed to uphold the Constitution. I don't care if you're a sheriff or a local police or Andy of Mayberry. You're upholding, and who cares who the top cop is when it comes to that? You know, even a soldier is not supposed to obey an illegal order to massacre a village. So I business of things are legal or lawful or are constitutional in one state, not the other, or the most ridiculous ever heard. You know, I don't care what the Articles of Confederation, we have the supremacy clause, equal protection, and all these other things. What's available in one state of what the, huh?
You're going in and out here. Are you on your good computer?
All right, well.
Good. Try.
This is your, but anyway, you get the idea. What I'm saying is I don't think we need to split all these hairs. You either have an oath to the Constitution or you don't. And what's available in one state is asking. I don't think it gets any more complicated than that. I think otherwise you're just giving credibility to the fiction.
Yeah, you're coming in and out pretty bad.
Okay, I don't...
We'll be able to...
We're not getting you, Gerard. I don't know if you want to try coming in on a phone or try reconnecting.
Continue.
Rebooting or...
Hello, Gerard?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, you're coming in bad. So you're going to want to reboot your computer or change computers or come in on a phone or something.
Are you muted?
What's that?
Are you muted?
Yeah.
Did you get to talk to Brent?
Yeah, he's on the call.
You talk.
All right, let's take our next caller until Gerard gets back. I'll take things up here. Fred from California, you got the mic. How you doing, Fred?
Pretty good, John. What I wanted to say was, it wasn't really a question. I wanted to clarify a question from Dave. Dave in Missouri. Now, I'm in California, but I've had opportunity to speak with Dave extensively about his situation there. He was trying to contact a group called Bikers Against Child Abuse. And I had sent that link out to members of NLA, and he was contacting me over that. But then he was telling me that in Missouri, the city that he's speaking of has seceded from the county. Now, I want you to understand this. The city seceded from the county. The county has no jurisdiction in the city. And the city established a sheriff in name only, without the power of an elected constitutional sheriff. This is what Dave was trying to communicate to you. He's very, very confused on what to do and how to do it. Now, this poor gentleman is 81 years old, and he's an army of one out there. He has no other members of NLA to support him. We went over in depth how he could get strikers, people to aid him. I tried to tell him that maybe the best thing to do would go back to the city and look up their charter and find out what it says in the charter about the sheriff and his responsibilities.
I don't know that the city has any power or authority to be able to rip themselves apart from a county. I don't even understand that. I never even heard of that before.
Well, according to Dave, they don't. The county does not want the city to come back into the county, because if they did, the tax burden from the city, you know, that chewed up and spit out their budget.
Yeah,
they
but
want
I would
more.
Think, I would think that this would be the legislator's job to deal with these things and to write law and to, you know, but for a city to secede or for a county to kick out a city, I don't even know if that's possible. I wouldn't even know how to answer that, to be honest with you. I'd have to think about that.
That's why I'm bringing this to your attention. It's not that you have to answer it. I am pointing out this poor man's frustration in dealing with it.
Right.
So now
right,
that we're
well,
on the same
page. The best I can say is, you know, maybe try emailing me as information concerning this, and I'll see if I can find some time to investigate it and see once what I could find. I mean, I would start off in the state constitution to begin with and see what you know, where you would go from there. But anyway, I don't have any other answer. I don't know if Brent's still on the line, if he wants to pipe in. If he has an answer to this, I don't know.
He's out there all alone. He's got no other support other than this
right,
little
well,
phone.
Help him to get the information together to get it to me, and I'll see what I can do. I'll try to find time to look into it.
I don't even know the name of the city, John.
Okay, well, he's going to have to contact me, or you're going to have to help him contact me to do this. Okay, John at NationalLibertyAlliance.org, and I'll try to find some time or pass it to someone else that can take a look at this.
All right, sir.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Fred.
It's the
okay, let's go to our next caller here. Jeremiah from California, go right ahead. And Gerard, are you back yet?
Hey, what's up?
Yes, sir.
Hello, Jerry.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
You sound good.
Okay. Other than my throat.
What'd you do, reboot?
I redid Skype. Kicked me off. I booted it back up. It seems okay now.
Okay, good. You got it. You got Jeremiah from California. He just started.
Oh, hey, Gerard. Yeah, he just brought me back on. Quick question for
you. Hey, how you doing, Jeremiah? What's up,
buddy? First of all, I just want to, you know what, I'm in Northern California. I've been living up here for 10 years, studying the law, working every day, just pretty much trying to get by and also learn, you know. So it's been pretty frustrating. And I just wanted to, you know, let you know that I have a lot of respect for the knowledge and the work that you guys do at NLA. So, I mean, I'm not. That's not saying I think it's completely unflawed, but I definitely feel like there's a lot of respect that I have for what you guys are doing. My question is really about the militia and about the how close are the militia related to police in of the city. This kind of relates to the question, the last caller's question, having to do with the city or the statements he was making. Because it's my understanding that the sheriff actually, under a municipal arm of the state, which would be, like a county, is the basic lowest fundamental arm of the state, right? That's the county. Now a city, right? There's no constitutional authority for home rule under the U.S. Constitution. So it would basically be non-constitutional for a city to opt out of state law without authority from the state legislators. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. And I agree that they're not really constitutional when it comes to their authority, the way that they run them.
So the sheriff then that is underneath the cities who are opting out of some of the state laws are not necessarily with the full authority of the United States constitutional sheriff because they've delegated that authority to the agencies.
Well, you
know,
can't do that.
That
the Constitution doesn't allow.
Right, exactly.
Transfer your rights or whatever. And look, just because they have a municipality with rules and regulations, the sheriff is still the top guy. He's the top elected law enforcement official. That puts him in a special place. All these other police forces, they're basically code enforcement officers.
Right.
And look, you can have a gated community. You can hire somebody to police it, and there's certain things that he can do. But there's many, there's many things that he cannot do. You know, he can only enforce those rules that everybody agrees upon that he should enforce. Because that's under mutual consent. But there's a lot of... He can't go knocking on your door and coming into your house and checking your apartment or anything like that. You know what I mean?
Well, what about the civil grand jury then? And how closely related to the common law is the under the cities that have sheriffs, cities and counties that have sheriffs or whatever... there's some common law thing happening there. So my question is to you, how closely related, and then we can move on, I guess, to the next caller, is the city's civil grand juries, right, closely related to the common law. Are they related at all, or are they separate?
Well, here's the deal. Look, even the way they're picking the juries is a problem, because you can't have government picking juries. And, you're supposed to pick them at random through the community. But if the government's picking them in order to adjudicate government things, of course the government's going to pick jurors that are sympathetic to its cause. And that's the problem. If you read Lysander Spooner, he gives you a whole reason why the government should not pick the grand juries. They should be picked by somebody who's not connected to that system. Because, the government's always looking for more power, not less power. Now, in as far as how they're related, I think the only way that they're related is, number one, if they really could pick a non-biased jury or grand jury, and they let them exercise their right of nullification, that's the only place that they would be come close to a common law grand jury. If they and sometimes they do exercise their right in spite of all the propaganda they're given, and they make the right decisions, juries and grand juries, because they get the proper story, and then they throw the case out. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen, and that's the best part of our system working in spite of all the obstacles that are put in its place. So it does happen, but we could guarantee it happened every time if they adopted the common law way, which would be that the judge is not instructing the jury that they're going to rule on the law and the facts as he gives them to him, and they're not allowed to rule on the law. They're only allowed to rule on the facts. And all these things that the judge instructs the jury that are, you know, in my opinion, that judge is committing treason when he does that, because he's getting in the way of that due process and putting somebody's life, liberty at danger.
Well, that's a trial jury, right, or a petite jury, but really the grand jury would be...
Even the grand jury has a right to look and see if there's a case to begin with. You know what I mean?
Right.
Usually never go against the prosecutor, but every now and then they do. And I think that's the most common law parts that are still in operation, where people are voting their consciences, and they say, you don't have a case.
But
you know?
Let me ask you this. I'm curious to find out, can we sue the members of the grand jury if they fail to act on an information that citizens give? Like the civil grand jury, you know, of the city or county, can the committee of safety, you know, basically begin to sue those people individually for not moving when they should have moved on an information piece?
Yeah, I don't see any way that can happen. Look, you got to understand that these people are being duped themselves. The last people you want to go after are the people that are being sucked into a system that they don't even have a clue that they've been sucked into. They think they're doing their duty. They're sold a bill of goods. So you don't want to chase after another victim. So clearly that wouldn't be the case. The individual responsible for that tainted jury, whether that jury understands they've been tainted or not, is the person who tainted them. It could be the prosecutor in the case of grand juries usually, and it could be the judge in the case of trial juries usually. Because when they tell them that they have to abide by a certain law, which is really a statute and not law, then of course that becomes a problem.
Okay, that's not me making all the noise, but thank you.
Yeah. Okay. I want to get to the next question.
Hey, yep, let's do it. Take care. Thanks a lot. Yep. Have a good one.
Yeah. Thank you. And by the way, nobody gets to the grand jury anyway.
The Committee of Safety wouldn't really be pursuing that kind of a situation. Look, the Committee of Safety is really concerned with anything that affects the safety of the community. And when they see a situation that hasn't been addressed and there is no protection of, that's what their purpose is. And then to be there and prepared for
right.
a potential security of that type, and to also develop a committee of correspondence, which would be a subcommittee within that committee, mm-hmm. in order to communicate with others, not only the people of the county or other individuals, but also and very specifically with other committees of safeties, like their sister counties and even across the nation, ultimately.
Interesting. Does Committee of Safety have to be authorized by the state, but you know what I mean, to operate in their city?
The people thing, period.
It's people thing, okay.
We the people. Yep, we have to
all right, next.
Free, be free and act free.
Thank you.
Okay, Gerard, you got it. Sorry. Gerard, did we lose you again?
Oh, I got myself muted and I'm talking.
Yeah.
Eric from Georgia.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hello? Oh, okay.
Yes.
Let's see here. On the advisory committee, the common law advisory committee, on the page is a library. If you click on the common law advisory committee, and it's got a book of legal maxims, And let's see.
Yeah,
here.
We were looking at some of that stuff. I know we were supposed to be working on that. The legal maxims sound very interesting, but go ahead. Yeah.
Well, what I was going to say was, it says the maxims are listed in Latin and table of contents, and I looked in the preface, and it said that it's both civil law and common law maxims, if I read it correctly. But one of these, or specifically the one it says on the page, is it says one maxim of interest, and it says it is the office, quotes here, it is the office of the judge to instruct the jury in points of law,
Let me intercede here. I'm somewhat familiar with that. I did speak with leadership about that. That needs to come down. Usually I do try to take a look at everything, and Gerard tries to take a look at everything to make sure that it is compatible to what our understanding of common law is, and especially doesn't violate the common law. And, you know, there are some books that were put up mistakenly that really get into talking about how to bring a jury together and do different things like that. And also this kind of a thing, there was also a library or some kind of a dictionary of some type that, again, you know, we have to really, really scrutinize before we put it up. So that should have been taken down. And so whoever is working the as the chairman of the committee, please take a look to see what's up there and talk with Carl about taking it down. And if you're unsure whether it should come down or not, you can get a hold of me or Gerard, and we'll take a look to make sure we don't take something down that we shouldn't take down. Okay?
Yeah, that's great. I appreciate it.
That's the problem right off the bat. As soon as you hit that one point, that's it. It's done.
Exactly.
It's tainted. It's not going to help us.
Yeah, and just to be clear on the page, it's underneath, highlighted in red, a selection of legal maxims, Herbert Broom, 1852. Like I was saying, I'm pretty sure it says in the preface that it's both civil law and common law. So all the civil law part might not gel with us, other than the stuff that, you know, we think we could use or is common sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I guess that's it, except that there is one more thing. I don't know if you – I don't want to take away time from anyone else, but I'm trying to –
Where is this on the page? This is under the committees, and it's
committees.
Under the Common Law Advisory Committees. And,
right.
Yeah, you go
and
to
– then training documents or library?
Nope, library.
Okay, I'll take a look at that. I'm going to go out there right now as we're talking. We'll go right ahead.
Third thing down, Herbert Broom, you'll see that one maxim of interest. I think it really goes, I mean, I don't know how, you know, it might have just been an oversight and someone put it there, but on accident or didn't really understand, and, you know, we're all learning. But I think one thing that, and I've noticed this before from other members, and it's what you say a lot, is we have to think free, and you mentioned it again tonight, and it's true, we really do. It's like you and Gerard and the other leadership, you're lighting the path of freedom, and we're making our first impressions on it. And then some of us who have this desire to supplicate, and I've heard it before, you can hear it in people's words, it's that, you know, we're not sure if we should get up off our knees because we've been on our knees for so long and we think we might get in trouble. And so it seems like sometimes people are like, well, you know, you can come back to this path of supplication because it's real comfortable and something that we all know. But anyway, I just think it kind of goes to that. But then the other thing was study and trying to understand the way the attorneys think. I heard you mention one time this law course. So I picked it up and I'm studying it. And right out of the gate, it has this thing called, a cause of action, and it says that abuse of process, and it talks about what abuse of process is, but isn't this what the entire, every courtroom in the country is doing? Is that not an abuse of process, what they do every day?
Well, yeah, I would agree with that idea. But look at one of the things we try to make a point of is we did get a course on access to the courts, on how to get into the courts and how to write papers and what are the necessary forms that need to be that you need to put together to file a paper and so on and so forth. And in that, you know, we pull together a lot of information and we make the point that. You know, this is for procedural purposes, but we don't necessarily adhere to some of these things. For instance, these courts go into what's called a cause of action. And when I first started to study law and to try to get involved in the courts and file papers, and so I followed that process. But as time went on, I learned more and more, and I come to understand that the only thing necessary to make a prima facie case is an affidavit. If you're an injured party, make an affidavit, you got a case. That's it. That's your cause of action, period. No one can deny that. Once you make that affidavit and swear to the injury or whatever the case may be, that's it. You're in the court. And they cannot throw you out, although they do, but they shouldn't. You know, they say, oh, you didn't fill the papers out right, or you didn't pay the money, or you didn't hold up your cause of action. You got to make 2 points or whatever the case may be. Look, at all of that is nonsense. That is in their statutory system, in their statutory courts. But people need to understand that if they're going to be dealing in these courts, and then they got to figure their way around it, which, again, you know, you have to start thinking free and acting free in order to be free. So, and that's where you start to make some big changes and big, take some chances. I mean, look at when the judge comes in and makes a rule and he doesn't have the authority to make that rule. You know he doesn't have the authority to make the rule. He should know he doesn't have the authority to make the rule. So what do? Well, you give him a writ of error. You know, a lot of people might be a little frightened the first time to do that. I know I was. And but as time goes on, you know, you start to act with the authority that you need to act with. The key is to get him to a point where he's wondering about you. That's the key. You know, you got to put him on the defensive to some degree. But that's also a dangerous thing to do, okay, because he could get you in contempt. And so, again, you know, you have to figure things out and you have to, you know, try to figure out what you're going to do and how, what kind of chances you want to take and how strong you feel about it when you move in those directions. The other thing we have a lot of material up there on common law, and there's errors in that too. But it's what we do have. It's a lot of great information, a lot of good understanding, and helps you to think free and so on and so forth. But even there, we have some false conclusions. For instance, there they'll teach you that you're the king of the court, where the fact of the matter is that the king of the court ultimately is God. You're acting under the principles of God. The bench, the people who are the jury, whether it's grand jury or trial jury, they're sitting on the bench of the king. Okay, and they're the ones making the decision. And if you're going into an equity court, they too are supposed to be operating under the rules of common law, even though they're in equity. And they too, being on the bench, you know, that one single judge who's an equity judge, you know, he's a magistrate or judge, shall I say, and he too should be acting on behalf of the principles of the king of the court. And he doesn't get to make up law or change law. He's got to apply it. And there's the, you know, American jurisprudence there to help him. And clearly the United States Supreme Court has helped him along quite a bit, telling him, hey, look, when it's something that you got to wait this side or that side, it's got to go to the benefit of the individual that is coming in as the plaintiff with the complaint, you know, or the action that has the injury. The right has to be presumed above the statute is the key. And so these are the way courts are supposed to work. And there are some problems on all of the materials out there, really. We have to have some common sense and think about it. But you do need the knowledge of how the courts work, all the paperwork and stuff. And you do need some knowledge and understanding of the common law and how things are thought out in different ways. And you do need to consider things logically, you know.
Hey, you know, John, recently the Supreme Court likes this thing that we're like employees, like they hit Bob Schultz with that and a couple other people, right, where they make this decision saying that you're like an employee. And then I've also read that, you know, if there's a presumption in the court and you go in the court and you don't kill the presumption, the Supreme Court has ruled that the presumption will be considered as fact if you don't rebut it. So there's certain presumptions the court makes as you go in, and it's up to you to rebut it. Otherwise, it stands. But this thing with an employee, like when you come under in a very statutory way, I just had an epiphany. You should tell the judge, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not an employee. That's for your employees. That's for your municipal guys. That doesn't cover me. I wonder what he would say. But anyway, I just
he had might
that
say
thought.
Contempt of court.
Well, no, I'm just looking. I just quote the law that they said about employees. I said, I don't know. I don't think that's a proper application of that. I'm not an employee.
Yeah.
I'm just asking a question of all law, Your Honor. I do not wish to be held in contempt.
Right, exactly. Well, again, you know, and I wouldn't worry too much about being held in contempt until you start angering the judge.
You always say, I do not wish to be held in contempt, because that sentence right there shows that you're honoring him. He has a real hard time when you put that on the record of holding you in contempt. It's just a little trick, and it's something that they do go by. You know, I mean, as long as you're not losing your temper, like you say, you know. So, you know, all due respect, you know what I mean? Those type of things, you know. But anyway, I'm going to move to the next guy here. It looks like Gary will. Go ahead, Gary. You got the floor.
Yeah, Gerard, just a question,
yes.
Or not a question, just a comment.
Mm-hmm.
On the last call we had, someone mentioned Fayette County in Illinois was not a non-existent county. That is a county in Illinois, and there was an individual listed as the contact for that Committee of Safety.
Okay.
Yeah.
I pulled up the directory. I don't see a Fayette listed in the directory, but there is a Fayette County, so you might want to check that.
Yeah, I did check the phone number for that, and the phone number is non-existent.
Okay.
That was apparently a misfiling.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks.
Okay.
That's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. Yep.
You bet. Bye.
Pamela Kilmer, you have the mic.
Hi. I'm just wondering, are you still going to the annual National Sheriff Convention?
The annual National Sheriff's Convention.
I thought that I was invited to speak there either June or July, I believe.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, I think there was a way back when we were supposed to get an application. We never did get an application, therefore we never did get it in. But we were never directly invited. But we were going to put an application in there as a speaker. Of course, if they invited us, we'd go.
Oh, okay. I thought that, yeah, I was hoping that was going to happen. I thought that would really, really keep things along there. Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah, if we were invited, we should figure that out. But, they might have invited us.
I thought I got an email saying that John was actually invited to speak there.
You know what? If you could dig that out, it might be important, because maybe we're dropping a ball here. I mean, it does happen.
Oh, yeah.
So much.
I'm not aware of that. So.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I remember hearing something about it, John, but I can't say whether you were invited or not. But I do remember the discussion that, and I thought they said you were invited, but I can't swear to that.
It was on a call when I first heard about it. For some reason,
I happen to remember that, and I don't remember. I don't even know where and when it is. Do you know where and when it is?
I can find it. I thought it was like June or July.
Okay, June or July. But it depends on where it is. I mean, if it's, is it local?
Yeah,
like toward
I was really
or?
Gonna look at that. I thought that would really speed things up.
Well, look, if you get any information, you should get back to us, because
okay,
it's
well,
something that
said,
we would be interested in.
I'll look for it. I'll get the email. And where should I... Send it to
Linda at National Liberty Alliance, and say
okay,
and put
that.
Down a you know attention John and Gerard Sheriff's Convention or something like that.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. Yeah. Bye bye. Next caller.
Hey, this is Ron in Southern California.
Okay, how you doing, Ron?
Pretty good. I don't have a question. I mainly have a little bit of an update or a statement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you know, my house, I was taken out of my house for pretty much by force over a month ago. And I have two active court cases going on in both the state and the federal appellate courts. They're trying to sell my house right now, even as we speak. So when I, by the time I get the date to go in either one of those courts, my court case will be moot. And I just figure I'd let you guys know that is the modus operandi that they're doing now.
Did you try to get some kind of injunction from the federal court to stop the state court, you know, to stop the sale at the state level?
Yeah, they you know what? I'm a pro per and I'm a homeowner,
yeah.
And they don't do
that. Yeah. Right. That's too bad, because really, technically, if you got a case pending, they shouldn't be able to move forward. And,
yeah.
You know, most of what they're doing is illegal. They're probably using an MREM procedure or some baloney. What was it, over taxes or over a mortgage?
It's over a mortgage. They're using different banks. They're claiming two different banks own my house at the same time.
Yeah, see, this is more that fraud stuff.
Yeah.
That's bad. And where do live?
They call it a non-judicial foreclosure. And if you look into, there's a list of states that actually have laws out for that. And obviously, if the state's not listed there, they don't have laws. But you'll find states that don't have laws listed there, I mean, doing that. As a matter of fact, I think New York is not listed on one of those, and yet they do it in New York.
New York
didn't
is supposed
to be. Did we check that? New York wasn't listed,
no,
right?
New York is a judicial foreclosure, and they're doing non-judicial.
They're doing non-judicial,
but they're a judicial state.
I mean, go figure that out. Non-judicial foreclosure, I mean, no due process.
But I understand you in LA do not agree with commercial liens. Is that true?
Well, we wouldn't. It depends on how it's being used and what lien you're talking about. If you're talking about a mechanics lien where you're doing work, of course, that's one thing. But no, to go through serving someone a notice and demand, and then they default on it, and you send them the default, and then you go file for a lien. You have to do an affidavit with the county clerk to file that lien and go through all the other processes. All you're doing is exactly what they're doing, and you're acting in rem as if, you know, and without giving these people their right of due process. We do those things personally, exactly those things, without the commercial lien. We then take it and move it into the courts for show cause why, you know, a judgment shouldn't be taken, and lay out the wherefore clause, you know, what we had declared in the notice, and give them the opportunity still to answer. They usually can't answer these things anyway. That's why they don't.
Well, in my case, it's,
but the thing is if you are in court over this, I presume you moved into federal court, right?
Yeah, you're
in
both courts,
both state.
Okay,
and federal.
And your cause of action, so to speak, you're moving it for cause, and that is for violating your unalienable right of due process. No.
Well, in this case, it's an appeal.
No, you don't want to do an appeal. You want to go, forget the court case. The whole process needs to be thrown out to begin with. You need to go after them. For violating your unalienable right of due process. They didn't give you due process. They did a non-judicial foreclosure. They took your property without giving you due process. That is, and they did it without the sheriff, too, because they have another game they play, and it's a fraud game that they use to do that also. But the bottom line is that they have failed to give you your due process. So you go after the individuals and let them go out and buy you a new house and also pay your restitution and your pain and suffering and whatever else you think you can get in there.
Hey, did you pay for the house or no?
Yeah, I paid for.
The house is paid for? The mortgage
was paid for, uh-huh. Yeah, I got the same law firm representing both Bank of America in one court and U.S. Bank in another.
Yeah,
it's RICO, pure and simple, my goodness gracious. I don't know. That's terrible. And you're in what state and what county?
California. Riverside County.
Riverside County. Where are those seven constitutional sheriffs during the state? They're up north, aren't they?
Probably, yeah. My sheriff here in Riverside is not a constitutional sheriff. You can't even speak to him at all.
Yeah, he's...
NLA sent him an informational letter. I tried talking to them, and they buffer you with all these different little underlings that will not let you speak to the sheriff. No way, no how.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tough, you know. When's he up for election?
You know what? I don't even know. Probably this year coming, probably.
Yeah, well, that's how you get them. I mean, barring anything else, I'm just telling you, follow them around and find out when they're doing their dinners, and you show up there and you catch them in public and ask them, you know, what she's doing about these non-judicial foreclosures where they're violating due process, and is he going to uphold his oath of office and stop them? You do it right in public as a campaign thing. And they won't like it, but that's the way you do it. I mean, that's the whole idea behind an elected sheriff, isn't it?
Yeah.
So. When did we send the paper out for you?
It's been well over a month. You sent it out April of 20th.
All right, what we need to do is try to follow up on those and make the phone call to the sheriff and see once what his position is and thinking is on in learning and obeying the law and the Constitution, and then we'll consider something else for him in something that's up and coming. Some sheriffs that outright tell us that they know it's illegal, but they're going to obey the judge anyway.
Yeah, it would need to be somebody representing the grand jury.
I'm sorry?
It would probably need somebody to announce that they're representing the grand jury.
Well, we didn't write the paper in the name of National Liberty Alliance. The paper was written under the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, so that's where the paper came from. And it went to him as an information to inform him of the law and explain to him how the law is being broken so he could understand it. And the follow-up on that would be your follow-up, and you would then do an affidavit saying that you went and talked with him and he said this or did that or couldn't get access, whatever the case may be, then that would give us opportunity to make the phone call then. So you have to do an affidavit on what took place, and you have to do as best you can to try to speak to this guy. But if you outright can't, then you do your affidavit. Speak to, his first lieutenant or his undersheriff or whoever. And then say, well, look, since I can't get him, you're speaking on his behalf. What are you going to do for me? And here's the law that's being broken. And again, if he says, well, we're going to listen to the judge and the bar lawyers, well, okay, you write that in your affidavit. We will utilize that to take the next step, which is to make the phone call and deal with that. And if he shuns us or ignores us or whatever, then he's going to go on to a list of something, we probably will add him at a later time on something else, which hopefully isn't too long. But we'll take another step after that, but it'll be a little while.
Well, what I don't understand is how do two banks come out after you pay your mortgage off and both of them claim that you owe them money? What's up with that? Did you just recently pay it off? They're claiming it wasn't paid off.
It's been paid off since 2011.
And they're coming back and saying that you owe them money.
The first time I heard.
And you have no contract with them at all.
None. And they can't produce nothing and won't produce nothing.
And they got you out of your house already?
Yeah. April 21st.
Really?
Yeah.
And who put you out of the house? Was it the sheriff?
The sheriff and the realtor.
The sheriff and the realtor. I'm sorry if that was me. I hate to tell you what I would do, because they have more than Waco on their hand. Look at, they're stealing your house. You paid it off, and they're not showing a contract. That's really bad stuff. Look at, that's worth dying over. I don't know that if they know that or not. That's war. That's an act of war. I don't care. You know what I mean? It's that serious. And somebody should come to the aid of that, some law enforcement official, you know? I mean, look at, where's the state attorney general? He's supposed to be there for the people. not to protect the government.
Yeah, but he's a bar guy, you know that, and
yeah,
he's been trained that this is okay, and he's on with the game usually. Very few bar lawyers are going to do anything right.
But I would still put complaints in. I would put complaints in all over because of those complaints, and I would do it officially so they all stand so that when you do get your day in court, they can all go down.
Yeah, remember, you know? If you're going to sue, if you have the ability to sue and go in under, you know, as yourself, okay, then definitely go into the federal courts for violating of your right of due process. And you need to put the pressure onto the judge concerning this. And you're not in here to play tiddlywinks, and you're not looking for him to give you some kind of summary judgment. You're in here for a trial by jury because these people stole my home. And I want it back.
See, he's in the federal court, but he's in with an appeal, and they completely
right,
control.
That's not the way to go.
Completely. Look, if you want to enter into the, you want to enter their crimes into the court. If you did a federal case and you made this case, and with these two banks and the sheriff and everybody else that you've noticed, and put them in the court, that's going to upset them because that puts their skin on the line. See, right now. Nobody's skin's on the line. They could give a dang less what you're doing. You got to get a case for your unalienable rights, and what you got to do is you got to go after them, saying that this is a conspiracy, it's fraud, it's this, it's that, it's RICO. Make all those claims and put it in on the record, and use whatever letters they sent you, or whatever. Use your payoff statement. And you got to make noise. You got to make noise.
It was dismissed.
Yeah, but U.S. 42, U.S. 18, RICO, conspiracy, and of course, violation of the unalienable right of due process. These are all the things you need. They're acting under the color of law.
You think the federal judge is going to turn around and dismiss that out of hand?
They did. I'm telling you, I did all that.
You brought those charges in?
I brought all that. The RICO charge.
Yeah, but the question comes is, how did you couch your case? And from my hearing what you said, your case was couched on an appeal.
It's on appeal now because I've been at this, John, since 2008.
Okay, so your problem was in a state court, and then you went and sued in a federal court.
Uh-huh, and then they kicked me right back down to federal, back to state.
Of course they will, because unless you go in for cause, which means you have to have a constitutional cause. The violation of your unalienable right of due process is your cause. Okay, that's your cause. In other words, they have to have jurisdiction over that case. And, you know, generally speaking, they don't have jurisdiction over your case. And even if you make the accusations that, you know, U.S. 14, U.S. 42 and U.S. 18, and you write all them up, they're not seeing your violation yet. You got to tell them. This is a case concerning due process, okay? And you're in there suing them for the damages, okay? And your damages will be your house to get. You want your house back. You want compensation for that. A couple of phones.
And look, they didn't dismiss your case. They kicked it back down to the state. That's not a dismissal. In other words, they sent it back. They said you didn't, exhaust your due process or whatever they said when they sent it back down there. Or they said they'd have no jurisdiction over it. I don't think they used the word dismiss. I mean, if they said dismiss, it would be dismissed due to the fact that we don't see jurisdiction. That's the only way they could dismiss that, which means you need to go back and rewrite it. And when you rewrite it and you make the claims, you see, that's what puts the judge's skin on the line. It's how you couch that. Look, that judge is not going to stick his neck out for those lower court judges, believe me. So when you write that case, you have to put his skin on the line by the way you make the accusation and for cause. It has to be, unalienable cause. You don't even need to talk about everything else that happened in the case. What you need to talk about is what they did to violate your due process and how they did that and the crimes they committed. And the unconstitutionality of it. So, I mean, some of this stuff is criminal, but nevertheless, the lower courts are not adjudicating it, and so they're violating your rights on that end too. But I don't know.
the fiduciary authority. Look at, you know, they have to, they play with trust to do this. You know, they have to get a trustee and
right.
And all this other stuff. Well, look at, if they got a trustee, who gave them the fiduciary authority over your estate? That's
yeah, they don't have those documents. You're right.
You know, and yeah. And then also, with their proof of claim, where's their contract? I don't see a contract. You know, again.
Well,
you know,
he asked them, and they didn't produce it. But the thing is the way he's asking and where he's going, they have control over that.
Right, but they acted in rem, okay, which
right.
makes it a federal case also. And it has to be filed. When they act in rem, they even go through the process and procedure of filing this paperwork in federal courts, okay? And that's where it's supposed to be filed. It never is. And in those filings, there's supposed to be two affidavits under Reform 4490 and 56. And I would imagine that would apply. Those particular forms may not apply to a non-governmental agency, you know, to a mortgage company or anything. But nevertheless, if they're acting in rem and they go into this non-judicial procedure process, which is in rem, then there must be something that they have to file. They have to file an affidavit of a proof of, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be written up the way it is on those two forms, but it would have to be one that proves that they have fiduciary authority over your estate, and the other one would also have to prove that they have a proof of claim, which would be a contract.
Right, which they don't. So he just has
and that you violated, you know, that you broke that contract.
Right. Anyway, I don't think we can say any more about that. I don't, you know, you need to do some research, and you need to, like, think about redoing, you know, how you couched your case and that. So, I mean, we have some stuff written up that'll help you, I'm sure. You know, that you could read on that, you know.
Yeah.
But this is getting to be epidemic. And so, you know, we got a couple of cases going that may help to facilitate the death of a thousand cuts, so to speak, because they're getting sloppy, they're doing stupid things, and they're getting arrogant, and that's when they're making bad mistakes that they can't cover up. So I would encourage you to go back and go ahead and rewrite the case and submit it under, like what John said, under, you know, for cause. Make those claims that way and then see what they do. Because you look at the federal court just kicked it out. They did the lower courts a favor. But once you put your affidavit in there, and you make those charges, that judge is not going to want his neck. He's going to tell the lower court, you better settle with this guy. You better cut it out because I'm going to fine for him. I'm not sticking my neck out for you. And they are jealous of each other's power, too. So, you know, make no mistake about it. They don't mind slapping the lower court judge, especially if he's saving his own skin. So couch it in such a way that federal court judge, in order to throw you out of there, has to actually commit a crime. Okay?
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, I hope that helps. Good luck and God bless you. You're not alone either, so we're working on it.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Richard from Virginia, go ahead.
Yeah, I was ready to buy a Jurist Handbook, and I see that they've sold out and been sold out for a while. You got an estimation on when you'll have them?
Ooh, that's a John question.
Yeah. When we originally bought them, we bought quite a few at one time. You have to buy quite a few. I think it was 50,000 or 100,000 or something like that. And, you know, we used that, and, you know, we normally would put money aside as we were going, but we had to pay bills, and we ended up paying bills even with the money that we had to go back out and buy more. So we're just out of money. We can't afford to do it. We did have some help on the original purchase, which was quite expensive. But until we get the funds to be able to go out and buy 50,000 or 100,000, we're not going to be able to do it. We were trying to work something out with some individuals, you know, that would do the site for us and sell different things, you know, like T-shirts and caps and bumper stickers and ID cards and also business cards, you know, with National Liberty Alliance type thing, and, you know, all kinds of things of that nature. And maybe they might take on the booklets also. But we haven't been able to really work out a deal. You know, we've had a couple of people interested in doing this, but, you know, when they start to go through the process, they never, none of them ever really finishes following up on it. They have to be a pain in the neck with me to catch me and show me, this is what I got, put up a mock-up site, and this is what we'd like to do. And, you know, they got to be aggressive to get the job. And so we haven't had anyone aggressive enough to get the job, and I haven't got the time to chase me. So.
Hey, do we still have the spot where you can print out your own, the little bigger one?
Yeah, I think it's still up there, the one for the court watchers type thing.
Yeah, we had that Juris Handbook for a while there.
The Juris. If you go where you buy the Juris Handbooks, you will get one. You can print it out.
You can print your own out, cut it, and make copies of it that way. You know what I mean? They come out pretty nice.
Okay.
You know?
If I took it to a printer. Do I need permission from you to print it at a printer?
Well, no. As long as you just print it the way it is, and you just print them out, and you're not selling them, you're giving them away. You could do as many as you want.
Yeah, it's got us. It's got
we give, been given, and freely shall you receive, freely you give. And
so
that's
the answer is yes. You can do that.
So we anything we do, you can copy and give it to any people you want. We want to get the word out there of all the paper. That we have.
That's all I had.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate that. Next question. It looks like it says Debbie from Virginia. You've been unmuted.
Well, this ain't Debbie. This is Curtis.
Curtis
from Virginia. I'm using Debbie's phone.
She listens.
We caught you using Debbie's phone. How's that?
we use the same phone.
Oh, that's
cool. When I'm home, we're using this phone. Anyway, the young lady that had called early, and I noticed Richard called, and I wanted to thank him for that. It was just kind of luck that we both met today and were discussing some things. And the young lady that called early, I had talked to her last weekend, Miss Carter, the young lady that has a case going in in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
She lives in Waynesboro, I think she said. And I spent some time talking to her last week, and I had, of course, previous to her, I attended a court case up in Arlington with a young lady. And since then, I've been studying a little more myself on the on approaching the court, on filing independent suits, and trying to learn more about the court. Somebody had also earlier mentioned something about the juries. I think it was another gentleman here that had mentioned about the juries and why we can't get the common law in them. But the problem is as long as they're U.S. citizens, they're operating under administrative law. And under this administrative law, all of these courts are operating under statutory codes. They're statutory. I just wanted to make a comment that when these people are operating independently away from the grand jury, what we're trying to do is to reestablish common law grand jury. That's going to be really hard to do while everybody's a U.S. citizen. I know that under the Black's Law 9th edition, D.C. Is completely under anybody that's a citizen of D.C. is absolutely and completely under the jurisdiction and the authority of the Congress. And that's hard for people to get the concept. And as long as we have this statutory connection to U.S. citizenship being domiciled in D.C., then we're under congressional authority. We're under their jurisdiction. And that's why we have these statutory courts operating in the state.
Look, it's fraud. It's fraud.
We all know that. But a lot of people who are trying to operate their cases out there are having difficulty in the... I'm talking about those people like the young lady that was filing a case in these courts. They're going in and they're filing because they don't understand anything about common law. They're being pulled in and operated under statutory law. And then any time you're going against these organizations like CPS, they're getting funding from the federal government. And that funding is being shared by the state. You're not going to get justice on either side. It makes it really tough.
Right.
But if they're going to operate on trying to file their cases privately, filing their suits, they need to learn how to do it under common law and how to invoke the common law court. And for the most part, they're having difficulty doing that. But there is a way to do it. You can do it through a claim. But most of these people, if you're getting an attorney, you're not going to get it over there because they're going to file as
the attorney will never do it for you.
They're filing a complaint. And if they're filing a complaint, that's statutory. You don't want to file a complaint because that right there pulls you into the statutory side. You have to file a claim, and you reduce it instead of 15 pages. It's one page, two or three, four line stops. One syllable word. This is what I've been learning through the study of this. And I've been trying to point this out to a lot of these folks that's where they need to go, is to learn how to write these up with single syllable words, just a few simple lines. Be very specific and avoid those statutory words. Don't be pulling in their statutes. Don't be pulling in all that, because you don't need to know anything about statutes. You don't need to know anything about the federal rules of procedure. All you need to know is, you know, I'm a man, you're a woman, and if you're going to talk to me, you have to do it as a man. So all of these other organizations like CPS, there is a structure and a magnet, and it's very successful from some of these people that I've been observing. And I think Carl Lentz has I don't know if anybody's familiar with him, but
I'm familiar with Carl. Carl's nice because he likes to do things in short paper, short lines, more.
Right. You know, he's very successful with that.
And
I think there's all these other gentlemen have a lot of things going for them, but for sure I think that's going to help them have more success if they'll devote it to simple, short, single lines. And maybe observe some of his material. He's got stuff spread all over the place. Not enough to where you can get it in just 10 minutes. I don't know what the purpose of that is. Maybe that's how he makes his living. I don't know. But he's very, very good with what he puts out. I mean, he's absolutely right. He is having success with it. But anyway, I just wanted to make attention, and I give up the mic.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's good. And we are familiar with Carl, and he does have some good stuff. And look, we do things, I don't know if you heard before when I talked about rebutting the presumption, and that's exactly what you need to do. And the other thing is their days are numbered, because there was a Supreme Court judge recently, he said, You can't establish residency by the fact that you have a contract someplace. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're saying you have a social security number, you have this, you have that. You are a citizen of the District of Columbia. Wrong answer. I'm a citizen. I don't have residency there. My residency is where I lay my head at night. And I can't take a contract in one state and claim that that's my residency and I'm living in another state. So there's plenty of Supreme Court rulings that show that. And plus, you know, you go in, you open a court of record, you accept their oaths and bonds. That lets them know that they're in a common law Article III court. And they have a duty to speak up. If they want to do you an admiralty, they got to say, well, no, we're doing an admiralty. And at that point, you say, well, you better produce a contract. You get the picture. But anyway, you try not to give them any credibility, but you also got to know how you're dancing and where you're dancing and what the dance floor looks like. That's the whole thing. So you really need to educate yourself, and you need to be careful when you're in court. And you know, you don't want to open your mouth too much until you get comfortable. So put it in the paperwork. Okay, the next questioner is Michigan Tim. You're on.
Hello, Gerhard. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My concern this evening is, since many of our people are incarcerated in prison who don't belong there, especially under common law principles, what do you think might happen if there was a collapse of government and the Department of Corrections? What would happen to all those prisoners?
Well, God only knows. I think it depends on where they are and who the warden is, and you know what I mean? I don't know, because I've heard horrible things. I don't even want to repeat them because I don't want to think about them. Because, you know, when you're a prisoner, you're less than. They feed them food that says not fit for human consumption. And you know what I mean? So that's what they think about those people. So what do you think is going to happen? First of all, do you think they're going to let them out, or you think they're just going to leave them in there and leave? Look at those.
I was wondering.
those prison guards got families, and if there's a big collapse, they're not going to hang around, you know, and not have their families taken care of. If they didn't make some kind of a arrangement that each prison guard, or, you know, doesn't have to worry about his family because they have a safe place to go, and I know they didn't do that, you know they didn't do that. You know, a guard in all good conscience should just open the doors and let them walk. And I mean, like the prisoners that are kind of notorious, like in the cases that we're running, where we have habeas corpuses that are getting ripe now. You know, it's up to us people on the outside to go over there in a mass and open those doors. And I think we can. And I think, you know, I'm hoping that the collapse doesn't come before we get them out. But we're very close to the indictments now. And, you know, at some point, it's a people thing anyway. So I would say, you know, it's up to the people to police that, the local people, you know, somebody. Mm-hmm. And it's up to the churches, too, because, look, they're the ones that take care of the downtrodden, and they were traditionally the ones that used to take care of the prisoners and the homeless and stuff. You know, we need a revival. We need these benevolent organizations to go out and take control of this stuff. And so, you know, it requires a leader in each community. A leader could do it, you know what I mean? Somebody who has that charisma or whatever else it takes to be a leader. You know, Chris Bryles, I met him. He was the former, he resigned as the county fire commissioner. He has leadership qualities. If Chris said, come on, guys, we're going to go get him out of prison. And Chris is a guy that would do that. He's a man of principles. And if there was a breakdown and he knew that nobody was taking care of him, he could get a posse up and they would go over there. And look, you get your sheriff, you know, if he's constitutional. And even if he's not, you say, look, you have to do this because this, you know, this is what's right under the law. I don't know what would happen if people would step up to the plate or what's going to go on. You know what I'm saying? I guess it depends on how serious it is. I guess it depends on, you know, what that breakdown is. Is there electric and power? I mean, look, you can't even get in a car and drive if you can't get gasoline. So, you know, it's all speculation at this point. I don't know. It's in God's hands. And look, you're going to do the right thing as a human being, as a man, and as a citizen of the United States. You know, and that's all I can say. I mean, I have principles, and I'm willing to die for my principles. You know, our forefathers certainly were. Why should we not be? So that's all I can say about that.
Okay, thank you for your concern on it, Gerard. I appreciate that. I might report that in our county here in Michigan, the state police post was closed, and they moved their post into the prison here in town. So maybe they're anticipating something where the state police officers will run the prison. I don't know.
That's very interesting. But again, did they protect the families? Do they have a plan? Look at that. State troopers aren't going to stay there if their families aren't protected. They don't have a safe place to go. Those guys aren't going to go to work when their wives and babies are home, you know, and they're fending for themselves.
If they aren't getting a check, why go, huh?
Exactly. So, look, I think their days are numbered because I think that's what's going to happen. They're not going to get a check, you know. So it's going to be very interesting. That might be our saving grace, you know, this whole thing. You know, the collapse might be the best thing that happens to us in a certain sense, because, you know, it's this government that's getting in our way. I think Americans would do fine if the government would get out of the way. I think we're self-sufficient. We're bright. We have a lot of technology. People understand the technology. We just haven't been given a chance to step up to the plate. And we shine best when we're under duress. We do.
And, yep.
You know, and so don't underestimate us, you know.
That's when we do our best work, isn't it?
That's right. So time is coming. You got to step up to the plate. Anyway, thanks for that. Yep.
Yeah, maybe they'll bring the Fed troops in or the UN troops to run the prisons, huh?
I don't know. I just hope they stick with their blue helmets because I want to know what my target's supposed to look like. Anyway.
I heard that. Okay, thank you. I yield.
I'll probably be in jail by morning. Oh, God, forgive me. Okay. I'll see you later.
Okay,
bye. Yeah, bye-bye. Linda, you've been unmuted, I think.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I'm so grateful, and I can tell that we've hit the first of figuring out what these states are going to look like. At some point, the leaders in each state will actually have a very good idea of the structure of what's going on and where to hit, and we will get the we will wake up our communities. I would like to know where I should put like a brochure that I'm giving to the people of my community that basically outlines very basic water, food, toiletries, and then goes on to gathering as a group on a regular basis, just to let them be aware. And I'm wondering where I would send that.
Well, look, there's
so that you could distribute it if anyone else wanted to have it.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and there's different ways that you can do it. I mean, I know when we were constituting New York, we did many different ways of announcements, you know. And we used to put flyers in the post office, flyers at the town hall, you know, put flyers all over the place. We'd drive to each town and put it in each town hall and each post office, and that worked pretty good. And the other thing was, you know, we had a penny saver that it wasn't too expensive to take an ad out in, you know. And I find that, you know, if you can get your library and announce a public meeting and then call all your friends, you know, you got to call people. If you put an ad in the newspaper, nobody will respond. You're lucky you get one, two people out of an ad in the newspaper, you know. But if you can advertise on that public access TV and some of these radio stations, you know, you're not making a profit. They'll advertise for free. Just advertise a meeting and put a catchy, you know, catch the people's curiosity to get them there. You know what I mean?
Oh, it's excellent. It's excellent. I'm wondering where I can send it so that maybe the people that are leading each area, if they want ideas from marketing brochures or whatever, we have a place
for us,
we can all learn. Because I can hear it in the voices of people. We're just right now just learning what the structure is going to be and creating it. So at some point, we're going to have a really good set of information to pull from.
Yeah, well, if you have something that you think that we should disseminate out that's good, that you're talking about submitting to us, where to send it for us, I think I misunderstood you.
Oh, no, you're right on. Like, I want to just put it in a forum and upload it into a forum that maybe we could all access so that we could put on notes.
Well,
like,
you need to send it to, you know, to us to look at, and
okay.
Then we would figure out where to put it and maybe where it could go in the form, you know what I mean?
All right, then I'll just put a little note. That's great. I'll just put a little note. Just
okay.
Submitted as possible thing. Yep, great.
Yeah. Okay,
thank you
very much. Yep. Bye-bye. Okay. I don't know what I did here. Okay, North Carolina. Is this Dietrich?
Yeah, this is from North Carolina.
Yes.
I was just going through the U.S. Attorney's Manual. Has anybody been through that yet?
The U.S. Attorney's, I haven't been. I don't know if anybody else has been.
Good section in there. Title IX on the grand juries.
Mm-hmm.
And even according to their manual, they're misusing the grand juries.
Well, that doesn't. Why doesn't that surprise me?
Okay, and you also have the United States Style Manual. Have you been in that?
I've seen it. I, as a matter of fact, those two things I sent away for a course in. I don't know if it was the Law That Never Was, and they included those two things as references. But go ahead.
Oh, you got to have them. In fact, in the United States Style Manual, they're talking about capitalization.
Mm-hmm.
And your name properly written in any document is upper and lower case.
Yeah, well, we know that they want to depict us as corporations, so that's why they do all caps.
Right, exactly. We understand that, but you got to be able to show them where it came from.
Right.
You know, you can disseminate it that way.
Yeah, well, you know what their problem is they always got some goofy statute or some goofy judge that made some goofy decision, and that makes them feel good, and they go by it. Well, somebody wanted me to speak on tonight about, you know, where what was the case and what court was it that said that common law was abrogated over here in New York. And I believe I'm just going to put this out. I'm using your time, excuse me, to answer a question, but I think it fits. It was Hughes versus Hayes, I believe, and there was three judges that dissented. You know, and I forget, you know, it was a, I don't know if it was a 9-judge panel or 7-judge panel. It was probably a 7-judge and 3 dissented. And it was, we read the ascending and descending opinions. The descendings were very good. And the descending opinion, the 3 judges said that this can't go because it's unconstitutional. And it wasn't a high court. It was a lower court in New York State. You know what? The courts weren't, like Brent said, the courts were never meant to be the be-all, end-all in the first place. So you get this appellate court decision, big deal. It's unconstitutional. Hey, I got 3 judges that say it's unconstitutional. And what we did is we wrote back and said, we, the people of national liberty, of the United States common law grand jury, agree with the 3 judges. And the rest of you, you're all in treason. The people have spoken. They never answered us.
Yeah, the speaker was talking earlier about the Marbury versus Madison.
Yeah.
It's all codes, rules, procedures are not repugnant to the Constitution, are not law.
Right.
And that was a perfect decision because your codes, rules, statutes, and procedures are all administrative. They are not law. Enforcing them upon the people is unconstitutional.
Well, you know it. I know it, and they probably know it too, but they pretend like they don't know it.
And they rely on the people's ignorance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And yet that's even in violation of the rules canon.
Well, it goes on and on, doesn't it? I mean, look at this has been getting worse for 100 years, you know. We're at the peak of this whole boondoggle that they're trying to pull off here. But, you know, look, we're winning the information war. I think more and more people are awake. Look, at the fact that that people could come on here and talk like you do is proof in the pudding right there. You know, it's right in front of your face that, you know, the people are awake. You know, the giant is ready to sit up and rub his eyes and stand up. And, boy, when he does, forget about it. We're going to take a kick with our foot and sweep him right out of the way.
Yeah, we missed a good chance in Virginia.
Well, we've missed a few good chances, but we're not looking. As long as you keep swinging, sooner or later you're going to hit that ball, right?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Good night.
Okay, good night. I don't know what I did.
Hello,
is that
folks.
Harley?
This is Harley. Hey.
Hey, Harley. How you doing, bud?
Made it through pretty unscathed. Won't go too deep on that subject. Just to put a plug out there for Earth Geek on YouTube, but I wanted to mention the committees of safety and the fact that New England's a small place. Rear up your patriotism. Talk to some friggin' people. Beat the bushes. Yeah. Talk to some people about what saved this country the first time. And talk to them about safety in their neighborhoods and bring them the history lesson if you can't get it another way. But I really believe in that. I really like John's work, and I think it's the foundation of getting to people act like men and women and take back from these disgusting people in the courts who are selling our children and all the rest of it. Okay? So just keep it short, and that's my thing. You know, look me up on Earth Geek on YouTube.
Thanks, Harley. You've been fighting a good fight. We need more people like you that can stand up and articulate. And I think you're very intimidating to them. And I think they're learning to respect you also. And that's, look at, yeah, what do they say? The beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord. And it's the same thing with Harley. You know, they got to start fearing us. You know, that's the problem. They don't, you know, when the government doesn't fear the people, then what do you have? You have, tyranny rather. But Harley, you've done a good job, and we're watching you, and hopefully, and we've had some victories, by the way. Well, matter of fact, maybe next week we'll start out by talking about the victories that some of our people have gotten, and they're using our stuff, but they're bouncing off of our stuff. They're springboarding because they're reading it and it's opening their eyes, and then they're taking it a step further. And they're doing some other stuff that we didn't do, and they're having success with it in conjunction with some of the paperwork that we wrote and some of the things we did. And we will, you know, we are going to document that stuff and put it up there for people to see, because I think it's important. I think it's important that we talk about our successes also, because we're also doom and gloom all the time. You know, there are some silver linings around these clouds, and we don't want to lose sight of what we're doing, and we are having effect. We really are.
It's just saddening to be on the reactive side of things. And
yes, it is. Yes,
we're better
is.
Than that. And I would like to see those successes and, you know, formulations on how we correctly put these federal cases, because I think that's just the Trump card, where you start to hold that's their peers, you know.
Right.
And you hold them to their standard that they're so elusive about, you know.
Yep. The only caveat to that is that you can't help that there's nothing as frightening as ignorance in action. If you meet a real arrogant, ignorant guy, it doesn't matter what kind of paperwork you put forward, you're gonna have to leapfrog over him to have success. Because you get one guy that sets his jaw against you and he doesn't care. I mean, that's not a reason to quit. It's a reason to go further and jump over him and then come back for him later. But it does happen. It does happen. Yeah. And look at, don't forget, you know, look at it. You're pretty articulate and you know your area. And so, you know, when you're out there, you're politicking. And court is a show. You have to put the show on. And you should be making your face known in those circles, because it's harder for them to do things to you when they know who you are, you know, and you're sitting down having a coffee, talking to them one day, you know, they're not going to feel so comfortable climbing in your window. You know what I mean? So at least we hope not. But I thank you, Harley. You've done a good job, and hang in there, and whatever, wherever we can help, you know, certainly we're going to do the best we can, because I know you do.
All right. Appreciate it, folks. Good night.
Yep. Good night. Okay. It looks like Rhonda from Washington, you've been unmuted.
Hello. Just a bit of information for you.
Uh-huh.
I am set to have my first Committee of Safety meeting this Sunday.
Hooray.
I got kind of lucky and picked up a former Committee of Safety group that had disbanded a while back. So I got some members that way, and then a few other people have come on, and of course we'll continue to try to add to it. But we'll see how it goes on Sunday and what we manage to get done. And then a second little bit. 6 months ago, I had given one of our office patients a common law grand jury booklet, and he is a district judge here. So he came back into the office today and brought the booklet with him. And I said, well, what did you think of it? And he said, well, it's a very good booklet. I will tell you that. And I said, okay, but I hear a but in your voice. And he said, a misinterpretation of a few laws. And I didn't have time to have a discussion with him. I simply looked at him and I said, common law or statutory? And he just kind of looked at me like, oh, crap, where do I go from here?
Right.
You know.
That was a good remark. Exactly. That was perfect.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. At least I've got him thinking. So.
Right. Right.
Just wanted to let you know that there's a few people thinking about us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to get more. And thank you. And of course, the more work you do, the better it'll get.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Uh huh. Yeah.
Okay. Looks like we got Anne from Mexico. Are you?
Oh, finally. Hello. I have some information about the Sheriff's Convention. It's in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on June 24th, 2016. I wanted to share that I have little slips of paper for the Committee of Safety, and everywhere that I go, even to the dog park when I'm walking my dog, I'm handing this information out. So we're still building in New Mexico the Committee of Safety. I put my phone number on there and say if you have any questions, please give me a call. So I'm directing them to the National Liberty Alliance website. Okay, the third thing is we as a group here in New Mexico had met on making a claim, not a complaint, and shifting the court over to a common law court. I have a paperwork. I want to send it to John to have John take a look at it and fill in any holes that need to be filled in. I'm going to do that. I'll ship it over to Linda. But we talked about having a members posting so that we can share documents, share experiences, and learn from each other, because many of us have been studying this for a long time, and it seems to me that answers are just starting to come through how to change these equity courts or statutory courts into common law courts. And this paperwork is pretty specific, and it might be an answer to easily gathering all of this information for the help of people so that they know how to do this, they know the language. And, I know we have a few experts.
Hello? Hello? Are you there? I think we lost Ann. I guess I'm still transmitting.
Yeah, I think she dropped.
Yeah. Well, we got some time. I'll go to... she's still there, but I don't hear her or anything, so I'll go ahead to it looks like Pamela again.
She's not showing up in the box anymore, but she is showing up on our other box, the active speakers, but there's a delay on that one. There always is.
Right.
She dropped.
Well, she'll have to try to get back in the queue. If she might have to dial back in. Yeah, she just dropped now, so she'll just have to get back in. So,
you got what, 5 minutes left? So.
Okay, so Pamela.
Yeah. Hi. Guess what? I found the email, and I found the recording where Gary has said that he had found something very interesting in the email in the question box, saying, asking John, would you be interested in speaking at the 2016 National Sheriff's Association convention? I just stopped it there when I got on the line. I had just found that. If you go to the recording I guess it says 15-10-12. So would that be October 12th, 15? If you go to the recording first, it says 15, 10, 12, and you go to 43 minutes, 30 seconds, you can hear the you can hear the invitation. And
right.
Then also,
so we have an invitation. Just a matter of whether or not somebody can get to it. Where did you say it was? Minneapolis?
Yeah, Minneapolis. And then in an email, I would
put out... Yeah, but there was an application, I believe, that needed to be filled out, and I don't think we filled out that application. And it had to be approved also. In other words, I don't know whether they would have approved us to go out to talk to the sheriffs. I mean, so.
Wow, because it sounded like it was an invite.
I don't think it was a direct invite. No, I think it was just...
Somebody, no, they did. They invited us. I think it was that whoever was running that thing invited you to speak. I don't know, but that, yeah, I don't know. When was that, 2015?
Yeah,
October 12th.
October 12th? Well, you might be able to ask Gary about that email that came in and find out who wrote the email. Who sent the question? Yeah, in the chair.
October 12th. Yeah, we'll have to see what the deal was with that and see if they still want us out there. But I don't even know if either one of us can make it out there as far as, you know, that's plane fare back forth a couple days probably.
That would be a great opportunity to speak directly with the sheriff and have everybody...
Yeah, that definitely would be an opportunity. I think we would go if we can get that opportunity.
Oh, that would be a wonderful opportunity. I mean, everybody, all those sheriffs together to hear everything firsthand.
Well, if there is an application and that we have to put in, certainly the information must be there. We'll see if we can follow it up and get it in and see if there's still time to have it approved. And we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
You know, I
but
mean,
there was, you know, put out on October 14th.
Yeah.
2015. Yes, open October. If you go scroll down to H, it says John has been invited to speak at the 2016 National Sheriff Association Annual Conference in June in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Yeah, I'd be interested. I would love to send that thing in and see what they do. Look at they didn't put us on the Southern Poverty Law list of subversives, so maybe we'll get in. we'll see what happens.
Can you hear this? Can you hear this? I'm going to put this on this recording. Hold on.
Oh, this is the recording of the call?
Yeah. Can you hear it?
Very low.
All right, so I've got the form, and I'll get it in your hand.
Good. Anything else out there? Okay, that was it.
Oh, Gary said I got the form, right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, then we have the form.
All right, well, it's got to be filled out if it hadn't been filled out.
Okay.
Wow, I hope it's not too late. That's
well,
like
we'll
a
find out tomorrow. We'll talk to Gary in the morning.
Good sleuth work. Thank you. Look, we hate to lose a good opportunity if we have one, you know.
That would be a huge opportunity, I'd imagine. All these sheriffs together to hear everything.
Yeah, well, that's kind of that's sort of our focus now, isn't it?
Oh.
I mean, look, we got to, you know, it's opportunities like that that you can light brush fires in their mind. And
exactly.
you might not get everybody, but look, if you just get a percentage, that's all we care about. You know what I mean? We're like the Marine Corps. We need a few good men to step up to the plate.
Well, I hope this works out.
Yep. Thank you for that. So
I'm sure glad I called
you were instrumental in breathing life back into it. So.
Well, I hope it's not too late. Okay, go for it.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thank you. Yeah.
We've come to the end of our call now. So. All right, we've come to the end of our call. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And again, we will be having a meeting this Thursday to further discuss, organizing across the nation. So anybody who could make it, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we'll endeavor to keep that under an hour. I know we went pretty long last time, but we had a lot of things to cover. But I'll probably be there for the beginning, speak for a few minutes and pass it on to whoever's running that program over there. Okay, and it'll be held in this room, the Monday Night Room, 9 p.m. Eastern. Okay, thanks everybody. God bless. See you then.
your fingers, the moon and the stars which you ordain. What is man that you are mindful of him, and the Son of Man that you visit him? O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all of the earth. O Lord, how excellent is your name. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name.
Is your name in all of the earth.